I did. Okay. Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for being so patient with us this morning. We had a few delays getting here from other parts of the state. I'm Cindy Gustafson, and I'm the newest member on the commission and just joined the Marine Subcommittee first meeting. And as you well know, I'm in the position of chairing today. So to my left is Bob Hattoy, our other commissioner, Bob Trainer, our executive director, and Adriana is busy running around, and John Fisher back here. From the Fish and Game Commission staff. With that, since I don't know many of you, if you don't mind, I'd like to go around the room and just have self-introductions, and that way we'll get to know each other. And then also in protocol today, this is the first meeting, I guess, the subcommittee meeting we've taped, and we need to ask you to come up to the microphone when you're officially speaking. So if you don't mind, we'll start over. How about here?
Sure. I'm Rick Albert from the city of Morro Bay Harbor Park.
Hi.
My department.
I will go this way.
Jim Marshall, Commercial Spears and Fisherman, former Admiral.
Great. Thank you.
I'm John Duffy, a former department marine biologist and former assistant. And I'm now working with today in particular with Spears.
Kate, you want to go?
I'm Kate Lane, the Natural Resources.
I'm Joel Greenberg, Recreational Fishing Alliance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Becky.
Bob Osborne, United Anglers of Southern California.
Steve Schimmick with the Otter Project.
And Vern Gary with the California Fisheries Coalition.
Matt Ryan, the Heritage Advisory Committee.
Kevin Morelli,
odd member of the
Herring
Group.
Dave Awakening,
United Anglers of Southern California.
Good morning, Tom Rafferty, United Anglers of Southern California.
Sam Liberati, Herring Fisherman.
Paul Whitman.
Citizen. And we had another gentleman join us here.
Pete Elmer, the president of the Cedar Tree Harvesters Association of California.
Great, and our host back here.
Jay Elder, Harbor Manager, Port St. Louis. Welcome, commissioners and staff. Let us know today. I think you for you to help out today.
Thank you for having us.
Just for the record, to some people's chagrin and to other people's horror, I'm not officially a member of the Marine Subcommittee. That committee is made up of Commissioner Rogers and Commissioner Gustafson, but Commissioner Rogers is having some medical work done at the hospital in order to keep this sane and legal. Cindy asked me to join today to participate, which I'm more than willing to do, but in the future you'll see Commissioner Rogers and Commissioner Gustafson doing this meeting. You just have to put up with me today. So that's where we are. Okay.
Great. So our first item on the agenda, Marcy, I think you're going to be heading this up. It's an update on the development of the Tanner Crab Fishery Regulatory Package.
Hi, Marcy. Hey.
This is kind of a lengthy discussion on the development of our proposed Tanner Crab commercial trap fishery. So what I'd like to do is go through the material that I've provided here, and Pete Calvis and Maria Vojkovic will also be providing portions of this discussion. But I'd like this to be interactive in the sense that please stop and ask questions. This is our best opportunity to really dig into the guts of this proposal, and it's quite detailed and extensive. And you have a 5-page summary here, but actually what this is a condensation of a draft initial statement of reasons for regulatory action, which is actually about 40 pages in length. So this really is the condensed version, believe it or not. What we're proposing here, Pete Calvis had presented to the full commission back in February, the results of an experimental deepwater tanner crab trap fishery that's taken place during 2003 and 2004 up off the north coast of California. And that fishery was an experimental fishery that you provided authority for through a special permit to fish these deepwater crabs with traps. Right now, the statutes do not allow for the use of trap gear for tanner crabs. So this was a special provision, exception that you folks made to allow this activity. And this is based on another statute, the Emerging Fisheries Legislation, which is designed to encourage the development of new commercial fishing opportunities in a sustainable manner and with a collection of data and so forth. So the fishery that took place off the north coast, as Pete will explain, was for a species called Chionocetes tanneri, which is essentially a cousin or a sister of a species known as a pileo, which is most commonly known as snow crab. It's the stuff that you buy behind the counter at Albertsons known as snow crab. The tanneri off of California is it's a little bit lesser quality, but it's still essentially the same product. And so the experimental fishery really was the first opportunity to see what kind of potential this fishery had for some development for a smaller, modest-sized fishery off of California. So with that, I think I'll let Pete go ahead and provide a rundown of the results of the experimental fishery.
Alrighty, thank you, Marcy. And as she pointed out, I did give a version of this description at the February Commission meeting, but I see some new faces, so I'll kind of briefly go through it again and add a few items. The groove tanner crab is the official common name, Chionocetes tanneri. As Marcy pointed out, it's cousin to more glamorous fisheries up in the Alaska area for snow crab and the like, and also a poorer cousin to the king crab. That would be sort of the pinnacle of this type of crab. Because as these stocks have become depleted, overfished, or whatever, many of those fishermen in Alaska and in northern waters have been looking to exploit other resources. The tanneri, Chionocetes tanneri, or the groove tanner crab, is found from Alaska all the way down to Mexico in deep waters, about 300 fathoms to 700 fathoms. And as Marcy pointed out, the commission authorized experimental gear permits for the tanner crab between 2000 and 2004. And there were 5 permits issued, but only one boat actually fished, so that it was only activated for 2 years, in 2003 and 2004, and it was the same vessel. Additional tanner crab permit requests have been denied pending results from the experimental fishery, which occurred in 2003 and 2004. And I've got some of the results from that fishery. You see, by going to the next page, the top box there, tanner crab are fished by very large vessels, as I mentioned, these boats from Alaska in deep water, far offshore, using large traps. Fishing vessel North Pacific is about 98 feet long, and the traps tend to be about 6 feet in diameter and require specialized gear to handle. Not to say that our California boats couldn't participate in this fishery, but it would take quite a bit of money and gearing up to do so, probably. And again, these vessels are typically active in similar fisheries in Alaska. Our experimental fishery yielded 212,000 pounds in 2003 and 460,000 pounds in 2004. There was an average ex-vessel price of $1.49 in 2003 and $1.21 in 2004. And I understand that the price has gone down a bit. It's the last time I talked to the skipper. We had different varying conditions on the experimental permit. Basically, we allowed them to keep the legal amount of sable fish we had 1,000 traps allowed to be fished at any one time, 100 traps per string, and they had to fish deeper than 300 fathoms to stay out of the trawl grounds to minimize interaction with our trawler fleet. And there were several other conditions on there, some of which we have modified or kept for the proposed regulations in the ISOR. The lower box there has Tanner Crab landing summaries for each. Again, it was the same vessel in each of those years. You can see we had over 200,000 pounds in 03 and almost 500,000 pounds in 04. There's a category under catch called dead loss, and that has to do with the amount of crab that are landed dead, or that when the boat comes to the dock that have died. And that number can be fairly high for this species because they're coming from such deep water, they're fairly fragile, and the nature of that fishery is that you can have as high as sometimes 20% of the catch landed dead, which is obviously something we want to avoid or minimize. The value was over $500,000, the ex-vessel value in 04. And most of the landings, you can see, were in Crescent City, but they're all either in Eureka area or Crescent City, all the landings in those years. And there was only 300 pounds of sablefish landed as bycatch in 03 and none in 04. So it's a fairly clean fishery. That's one thing in its favor. Going to the next page, got a picture of the fishing vessel North Pacific deploying its large pots. We have a big hydraulic pot launcher and line coiler, and you can imagine the miles of line that you have to deal with when you're fishing at an average of 500 fathoms, or 3,000 feet down. Typically, their crabs pots are put on one long string of. They were using an average of maybe 70, 80 traps on these strings. They could be 2 miles long, sitting on the bottom with a buoy on either end. And that did cause problems sometimes with our trawlers who would be going through the area. And, of course, if there's 2 miles of traps on the bottom, you're not necessarily going to see the buoys on either end, and you can go right through that gear. As it turns out, it causes more problems for the crab fisherman than it does for the trawler. The trawler can kind of bust right through it without doing much damage to his gear, but it can really mess up the string of traps. So it's in the best interest of the crab fisherman to let the trawlers know, let as many people know where he's fishing. And this particular skipper, these skippers actually did try to make a good effort to let people know, let the trawlers in the area know where they were fishing. There was a bit of a communication breakdown in the Fort Bragg area because they were fishing out of Eureka, and sometimes they didn't communicate as well with the Fort Bragg fleet. You can see the little chart below. The photograph is where the pots were, the traps were deployed in spring of 04, and that stretches from the Trinidad area in Humboldt County all the way down to Point Arena at an average of 500 fathoms and 10 to 40 miles offshore, with most of the activity in the Cape Mendocino area. Not to say that they wouldn't fish farther south in the future if they have the opportunity, because the crab are certainly, we know that they're pretty abundant from, say, San Luis Obispo all the way up to the Oregon border, and that's from National Marine Fisheries Service surveys that are done every 3 years. We've been lucky enough to get biomass estimates from that National Marine Fisheries Service survey work. The next page, you have a little bit about Tanner crab biology in the top box. Based on other Tanner crab species, and it's not known exactly for Tanneri, but the lifespan is thought to be 15 to 19 years, which is pretty long for a crab. They, both males and females mature somewhere between 5 and 6 years for Tanneri. And size of maturity is about 4.5 inches for females and about 3.5 inches for males. And we're proposing 5.5 inches as the minimum legal size. That's the width of the carapace across the back. Spawning is January to May. They're generally thought to have a low natural mortality rate and that would lead to a recommended low exploitation rate in order to have a sustainable fishery. I suppose if anybody wants to have questions, they could break in, or if you want to wait till the end. Okay. Tanner crab juveniles are an important prey item for Dover sole, thorny head, and sable fish, or what we call the DTS complex, which is a very important component in our trawl and trap fisheries. And so we do want to keep that in mind. We're talking about exploiting this species. Let's see. The bottom box below shows some of the observer sample data. The experimental permit required that approximately 25% of the trips have an observer on board, National Marine Fisheries Service certified, collecting biological data. And so we did get a lot of good information from that observer. And we would require something similar in our proposed regulations for an actual fishery. You can see that male tanner crabs, this is data that when the pots were brought up in 2003, comprised almost 75% of the catch and almost 90% in 2004. And of those in 2003, about half of them were of legal size, and only about a third of them were of legal size in 2004. And you can see the bycatch of other species was very small, less than 1% by number. Going to the next page, the size frequency of the males and females that came up in the traps in 2003, this gives you an example of what we'd be dealing with. If you look at those little bars, I know the numbers at the bottom are a little difficult to see, but there's the 125 bar, which is about almost halfway across the x-axis. Our proposed size limit would be at 127 millimeters, so it would kind of go down the center of that bar. So to the left of that, all those would be thrown back, and you can see the white bars are all females, so all the females would have been under the carapace width. They would have been thrown back anyway because we're proposing a male-only fishery, but it gives you an idea the females are generally smaller. That's pretty much all I had. I did have a last page on how we came about to our proposed annual harvest limit, the calculation of that in the top box. Basically, the thing to take back from there is that based on the National Marine Fisheries Service surveys, for the 6 years between 98 and 03, we estimate that the biomass averaged 40 million pounds. And there's plus or minus quite a bit on this estimate. There's quite a bit of variance on it. And then we applied the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, British Columbia's research for the next bullet. We estimated 38% of that biomass would be legal males, say about 38%, or about 15 million of those pounds would be legal males. And again, going by British Columbia's recommendation, they've been studying this resource for quite a while, and this is also in line with what Alaska does. We'd recommend take about 10 to 15% of the legal males to be a conservative, sustainable harvest. And that comes out to about 2 million pounds per year, so that's what we're proposing. And we do have a box on estimating costs of managing the fishery for your perusal. Connie Ryan developed that for us, and that's about all I have. Anybody has any questions? Sure.
Let me just figure this out. Under the current experimental fishery thing that we've been conducting, where is the current width size? I mean, you say it's going to about 127 millimeters. Where are we?
Yeah, that's 5.5 inches or 127. That's what we
want to see.
That's what they were required to do during 2003 and 2004, and that's what we would want them to continue to do.
Which gives them all that
to the right
to fish.
Yeah.
Which still eliminates the females.
Yes.
Thank you.
And it would be male only anyway. They would still have to return.
Yeah. But they could sneak them in if it was, you know, the wrong size, not on purpose. The other thing is the question I have, just it came to my head when you said it. You said that the whole decision based for this fishery was based on an estimate of a 40 million pound biomass, or 40 million something biomass.
Yes, 40 million
pounds. But you said that had a variance very wide, plus or minus, which to me is going to make the folks who don't like this or the folks who do like it call into question the very basis of it. I mean, how big of a variance? 60 million? 20 million? I mean, you say a big variance, which makes the data a problem again.
Right. It's just the nature of the survey methodology, but it could be in the nature of 10 to 15 million pounds, high or low.
Okay. Okay. And, you know, and that's going to be the subjective decision we're going to have to make eventually.
Sure.
And so when you're asking eventually for 1,000 pots to 480 from, you know, 1.5 days out there or something from, you know, to a 5-inch width, there's going to be a lot of argument about whether that's needed because of a 10 to 20 million variance in biomass.
That's correct.
I'm just hoping you guys can give us it more specifically eventually. And I know that's not your fault because, we're dealing with best scientific data. But that's the question we always have to make a scientific decision on.
I know.
You know, a political decision based on scientific data. No one's fault at this point. Everybody agrees that there's a variance. But when a fisherman comes to me and says, I can't work anymore because I only have 480 pots and your department's telling me that it's based on 40 million. Well, I know there's 50 or 60 million out there. I don't know what to say to that guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I'm asking you as a biologist to help me out here.
Well, maybe I can help you a little bit. There will always be a variance when you're dealing with natural populations.
But when you say big variance, that worries me, you know?
Well, yeah. Maybe I should have.
You said
that's subjective. Subjective. I guess I could say that it's not a variance that's out of line with other species in the ocean that have this large of a biomass or this large of an estimated biomass. So in that sense, it's not unusual.
Right.
In fact, I think we're very fortunate to have a biomass estimate for emerging fishery. Most of them we don't. You know, even a lot of our existing fisheries we don't. So we're very lucky in that regard. And I think, you know, if somebody's going to approach you, you could mention that to them, and I think they would recognize it, too, whoever
Absolutely.
Would approach.
No, they are very, yeah.
You know, the other thing I should have mentioned is that there's a bycatch that goes on with our trawl fisheries, and Marcy just recently got some good numbers from the National Marine Fisheries Service Observer programs, and that can be as high as 1.5 million pounds a year, some of the estimates,
and
that's going on and has been going on for decades, this trawl bycatch of this species, and it's been able to sustain itself with that going on. So
sure, and I understand all of that.
Okay.
My question, as a biologist, to you—I mean, I'm not a biologist; you are. How, and I mean this either theoretically or how can we make it more specific in the future? I mean, how, do we need more scientists, more studies, more? I mean, we need obviously a lot of this next 3 days is going to be people asking us, how does the department make decisions on, you know, on resource issues? And I'm just wondering, I know as a scientist, you'd like to see it tighter too. So I'm wondering, how do we get to that? And is there a way?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to put it in perspective, Alaska doesn't even do surveys on their tannerite resource because they are so deep and so difficult to sample. I think, you know, because we're getting this data from the National Marine Fisheries Service and they do this every 3 years, really targeting, really for another purpose. We're lucky that they happen to be catching and counting tannerite for us.
Yeah.
So it's really like a gift when we look at it.
It is. Absolutely. It's good to have.
I just don't see that we could, you know, without a huge expenditure of effort and money, improve on this number. So I guess I don't want to be a killjoy or naysayer, but this, I think we're very lucky to have this number, we're probably not going to be able to improve upon it realistically. What I could do is try to provide you with what that variance is more exactly. I think we could refine the estimates of what the variance is, and I think that would
help.
Probably be the best we could do. That
just
would
I like to fairly answer people's questions.
So yeah, and I think you'd be very fair in doing that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Marcy, did you have some more comments?
Yeah.
Here? Okay.
Thanks.
I just kind of got into more detail there with the development of the proposed harvest limit. I sort of trying to keep to the summary sheet on the rundown here. So we kind of got ahead of ourselves a little bit. But I just want to go into detail about some of the elements of the proposed program itself and the permit requirement and all of the conditions that we're proposing that you establish that go with this permit. First of all,
this would be a specific permit just for the take of tanner crab with trap gear. It would be issued by the department annually, like our other commercial fishery programs and permit requirements, you know, a specific tanner crab trap fishery permit. We have probably 20 other such permits for specific fisheries. On to the seasonal catch limit, as Pete mentioned, just to follow up on the trawl bycatch issue. Our groundfish trawl fishery that operates in Northern California has been scaled back substantially since the 1980s. This fishery, due to concerns with overfishing and overcapitalization, actions by the Pacific Fishery Management Council, the federal management entity, have resulted in reduced groundfish catches substantially. Previously in the 1980s, we were seeing catch volumes that would equate to a tanner crab bycatch of up to about 5 million pounds a year. And now that number in recent years is more like 1.3 million pounds a year. So you can see that really our proposed 2 million pound per year harvest limit for the trap fishery, really the same level of catch had occurred year after year in the prior groundfish trawl fishery. So really we're just changing the gear type, and instead of it being a bycatch and discard fishery, it's actually a commercial fishery with a landed product. So in that sense, we are comfortable when you look at that number of 2 million pounds. I mean, we've already reduced the catch on this species just by the actions, you know, incidentally, from the Pacific Fishery Management Council. Another thing that we are somewhat concerned with is the discard mortality that might occur with this fishery, and that's why it's very important to continue our data collection protocol. We've been collecting data on the number of released females and males, as Pete points out, but we don't know the survivability of those released crab. Our best guess is by looking at other studies for other related species, and also looking at what happens to the crab that are caught with traps and then saved on board to be landed, how many of them die, the dead loss that occurs. That might give us some idea of how well these crabs survive when they're released. And looking at those numbers, based on the results from the experimental fishery, between 6 and 10% in 2003 and 2004. But again, that's something that we want to continue to look at, and possibly, you know, as we continue to collect additional information, that we'll be looking at that 2 million pound harvest limit relative to that. Moving on. Hang on.
Yeah, the thing we're reading. Hopefully it's the same
reading
thing.
Reading and marking.
Yeah.
Onto the trap limits. As we mentioned, the whole premise for the development of an experimental gear permit was because current statutes don't allow fishing for tanner crabs with traps. So one of the big focuses of the proposed new fishery is to deal with authorizing specified trap gear. So we had to spend some time developing requirements for the use of traps, also considering what else we have in place for other trap fisheries in California. So the first place we looked was to our existing requirements for other trap fisheries. And right now, all trap fishing in California is subject to a trap logbook requirement where the operator must fill out daily a record of the fishing activity, the number of traps that were set and pulled, the areas that were fished, etc. Also, there's a destruction device requirement for all traps. And what that does is, if a trap is lost, if a trap is deployed out in the water and it's soaking, and for reasons like bad weather or what have you, the trap is lost. A trap destruct device allows for the animals that are inside the trap to get out when it's essentially a timed release. It's they call it a rot cord. And after a certain amount of time, it deteriorates in seawater, and then the trap opens so that animals can get out. So we will continue to require a destruct device that's actually specific for tanner crab, because tanner crab are a little larger than some of our other trap fisheries, the targets of those fisheries. We're also requiring buoy requirements, other identification requirements for traps, and that traps be designed with escape ports that are 4.5 inches in diameter, and that would equate, that would correspond with our proposed size limit for tanner crab. So that this, what happens is the trap is out there fishing, and the little crabs get in the trap, and the escape ports allow them to get out, and so the little crabs don't have to come to the surface to be released. So it lets them fish and only retain the big crabs. We're also proposing, and this is consistent with Alaska regulations, that traps be 10 feet long by 10 feet wide by 42 inches high. Those are big traps, very big traps. But considering that we expect interest in this fishery to come from many of the people that are up in Alaska, we felt like we didn't see any particular need for them to have to invest in brand new gear to come down here and to fish with a smaller size trap. It wasn't a focus for our study of the experimental fishery. So we decided that being consistent with Alaska for this piece was probably okay. Pop-ups. Pop-ups are devices that allow a buoy on a trap to be submerged. So it's not really visible from the surface of the water, and so we're recommending a prohibition on pop-ups for this fishery. We don't expect it would be a concern, but we just want to address it up front. Also, that would serve to minimize the interaction with the groundfish trawl fishery, because if they can't see the traps, they're not going to know how to avoid them. So we're requiring that the buoys be remain on the surface and be marked it.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah, here? Please.
I'm still trying to understand pop-ups that we do allow in the lobster fishery, mm-hmm. that we don't allow here. Just explain to me that, because I don't know enough about that. I mean, I know we allow it in the lobster fishery, and it's causing a problem with some people. Why do we allow it in lobster? Why aren't we going to allow it here, and what's the difference?
Well, actually, we prohibit it in nearshore finfish traps. We authorize it in lobster. Now we prohibit it in rock crab as well. There are reasons for it, particularly in high-traffic areas. Fishermen like it because they can continue to use their trap gear in areas that are used for vessel transit.
Right.
But the buoys stay under the water, and so it avoids tangling when other boats are driving around. And then they surface at a particular time, and then you go pull your traps.
So they know when they're coming up, and they know when to go get them.
Yeah.
And the lobster guys like that?
Yes.
But the other fishermen around them don't, right?
Well, it's not so much that. It's more of a concern for enforcement.
Okay.
Whenever you're thinking about establishing like a limit on the number of traps, for example, if you can't see them, it poses great difficulty for enforcement to have to go out and and count the number of traps if they're submerged.
Got it.
And again, for this fishery, we aren't anticipating that people are going to be interested in using it, but it's just one of the things we wanted.
Just confusion about we allow it in some places, not in others.
Right. We're also recommending that traps be set only in waters 300 fathoms or deeper. And this is because, first of all, tanner crab really aren't very abundant in waters shallower than that. But also, by keeping this fishery in deeper waters, we're preventing any interaction with the Dungeness crab fisheries, which operate shallower. The next item, trap and string limits. This is one that we spent quite a bit of time on. Even though this fishery operated quite a distance from shore and in rather remote areas, we still had documentation of interaction with the groundfish trawl fishery, as you've heard. And this was with only one experimental fishing vessel operating. And so we did spend quite a bit of time looking at that and how to minimize interactions with groundfish trawl activity. We believe that limiting the total amount of gear that each vessel can use in this fishery is a good idea. We're proposing a limit of 6 strings of traps. This fishery is with traps that are all tied together on a long line, where it's not like lobster or crab, where the traps are set individually and marked individually. We're proposing they be allowed to use a string of traps of not more than 80 traps, and not more than 6 strings of traps. And
up to 480.
Up to 480, so 6 strings of 80 at a maximum. And the way we came up with this number is we took into consideration our existing statute on soak time, and the servicing requirements of the Fish and Game Code say that you must pull any trap and service it every 96 hours. And so we, knowing that, looked at the experimental fishery data and then kind of back calculated, well, how much gear can he effectively use in that 96-hour time limit? And looking at his average performance in the experimental fishery of 176 traps pulled each day, and that he fished on 62% of the days during the time period that he was active, we calculated that within the confines of that 96-hour soak time, he could fish 436 traps. And so we're saying, okay, given other considerations with, you know, gear loss, what have you, 480 was, a little above the average, and that to us seemed like a reasonable trap limit in light of the information we had. Now, what must be considered is what was being utilized in the experimental fishery. In the 2003 experimental fishery, we authorized up to 600 traps, and then in the 2004 fishery, we authorized up to 1,000. And looking at the results of the experimental fishery, we looking at the average soak times that were provided, only a small number of the strings and the sets that were pulled were in compliance with that 96-hour requirement. And consequently, we, again, back calculating with that 96-hour limit, 480 was the number that we determined would keep within the allowable limit.
Question?
Yeah, please.
We have a letter from somebody that I read just now that says that the change will allow only for a day and a half soak time. Is that just incorrect figuring?
And
if that's the case, they're saying, I just need an answer.
Sure.
That it won't give time for the big crabs to get in and the little crabs to get out. So how do we answer that, or is that just the wrong estimate? I mean, I don't know the answer, but I feel like I need to know that.
Well, the statutory soak time that's established by the legislature.
Okay, so we don't do it.
That it is what it is, and we designed the program with the legislature's thoughts in mind. And in terms of this was the data that he provided from the experimental fishery. I mean, again, it was 176 traps a day, and that he fished 62% of the days. He wasn't fishing every day. There are weather concerns and, transit time in and out to offload, so that's going to reduce the number of traps that you might use it, as opposed to if you were fishing
straight. Yeah, but in establishing an emerging fishery regulation, shouldn't we look at what was done under the experimental fishery? And you might look at the statute was established for 96 hours, looking at probably more shallow type fisheries rather than a deep water fishery. And that's one of the things that we were looking at under the experimental gear permit. And to execute the fishery that they may need a longer soak time, shouldn't we consider amending the statute for a deep water trap fishery rather than go with what is existing for more of a shallow fishery? You look at Oregon, they have a 7-day soak time.
Right. And I will point out that the terms of the experimental fishery did incorporate that statute as a requirement of the permit. Section 9004 was an express term required in the experimental permit. So he was bound by the 96-hour soak time. Mm-hmm. And the statute has a little...
But that's not my question.
Okay, I just wanted to make that clear.
Well, I know that. But.
Yeah, but I think your question is right on. I mean, like, if the legislature in its wisdom created a 96-hour limit, but this fishery didn't exist, or this type of fishery didn't exist in the creation of that,
right?
And we're creating a new type of fishery that wasn't existing at the creation of that, how do we make it work in the real world, either asking for a change in the legislation, or can we regulate that? I mean, or do we even need a change? All I'm saying is I think Bob's right. This didn't exist when they created 96 hours. And, you know, I'm just wondering if it's reality for us not to look at that.
Well, just for background, I'll say that we started with the statutory provisions that are in place.
Sure.
I mean, and I don't really know under what authority the commission would have to do it. So we really didn't evaluate, whether or not it was practical in light of that. We started with the statutes
with
that are in place.
With that premise, and then you
backtrack. I mean,
from
I get
there.
That.
Right.
But, Sanky, we're in trouble.
Yeah. I was enjoying hiding behind the bar there. Obviously, we have to design a fisheries with the existing statute. We are not in a position to change it. We can certainly recommend changes. If the commission believes they want to offer a fishery that has a longer soak time, that, of course, would require going through the legislative change process, and just it'll take time.
And I don't know if we do, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, I mean, it just Bob makes a good point. The 96 soak time, hour soak time, was probably promulgated through the legislature under different circumstances. If the commission wants to offer longer soak times, that's going to, you know, take a while, and that's certainly something we could look at, but we have to go to the legislature for that and to change that, and there's going to be all kind of ramifications for the closer fisheries, because of course I'm sure other fisheries currently restrained by 96 may be interested in also being included in longer soak times, and that can have problems with bycatch issues and all kinds of things. So it would delay adopting this fishery, but that's your prerogative.
No, we don't even need to do that. I mean, this is an evolving fishery,
yeah.
Obviously. Obviously, we should do it under the law, but
right, that's
later,
true.
If it looks like stuff comes forward
that's
that we need to change it, we have
the
ability to do that. Okay, thanks.
We did take a look at the results of the experimental fishery in terms of did a longer soak time result in improved catch efficiency? In other words, if you soak your trap for 2 days, are you going to catch fewer crab than if you soak it for 11 days? We did have that information that we could look at. And in fact, it did not demonstrate that there was any improved efficiency the longer the traps soaked. And again, just to respond to the comment regarding Oregon, and I was going to get into this more with the summary table that I provided you with the management measures that are in place for the different states. Oregon has a developmental fisheries permit, and for deep water crab trap fishing for tannerai. And as Bob pointed out, they do authorize a 7-day soak time. However, they have very restrictive gear constraints on that permit. They actually do it by weight rather than by the number of traps. They require that you can't set more than 2,500 pounds per string, and each trap may not weigh more than 300 pounds. So that would result in about
10 traps per string was what they estimated. And the reason that they implemented that restriction, I guess, was that, and this goes back some years, it was based on concerns with interaction between the groundfish trawl fishery over, you know, essentially using the same areas for two different fisheries, one with trawl and one with trap. And so that is an ongoing requirement in their fishery. So really, our in light of that, our trap and string limits are relatively liberal. Also, you can look at the comparison chart in the other states, particularly the Alaska tanneri fishery, which is also a developmental fishery. They only authorize the use of 100 traps per vessel. So our proposal of 480 traps really is quite in line. Actually, it's higher than any of the other areas authorized for any other of these other developed crab fisheries. Moving on in the next item, processing at sea. We did have some interest in being able to process the crabs at sea from the vessel. In other words, it would be landing crab in a frozen cluster condition instead of whole live crab, which is what took place in the experimental fishery. Because there was interest in this, we did look at how we might craft some regulations that would accommodate this, and we were able to come up with a conversion factor that would allow us to calculate the... Because what happens if you land crab in a processed condition, it doesn't weigh as much as if you land a whole crab, and consequently, on the fish receipt, we need to be able to document for tracking the catch limit... crab that's landed processed versus what's landed whole. So anyway, we are proposing to authorize that, but just with some additional reporting requirements. Cumulative vessel trip limits, that's the next item. We're proposing to limit the amount of crab per vessel to 250,000 pounds per two-month period. And this is a management measure that's seen often in our groundfish fisheries and other fisheries. We have them in our nearshore fisheries as well. It's a limit per boat for a two-month period. And what the limit does is it essentially slows the catch down so that it's landed throughout a longer fishing season, and so that one or two boats don't essentially take the entire harvest limit. So it's not like an IFQ program or something like that, but it does, what it does is it serves to cap efficiency on vessels it reduces their incentive, for example, to use more gear, to develop more effective methods of take if they know that they are limited on a per vessel unit basis to a certain amount of catch in a two-month period. And the limit we're proposing of 250,000 pounds is actually very, very liberal. That's the highest that was observed in the experimental fishery for any two-month period. But what we're saying with that measure is this was the highest production that he operated at, and we don't really want to see it get any higher. Many of the fisheries that operate elsewhere are known as derby fisheries in the sense that there's a set amount of fish that's available to be taken, and they all are racing to catch the fish kind of against the clock. And when the harvest limit is attained, the fisheries close down, and so it's kind of like a race.
A great Discovery Channel program.
Okay, excellent, yes.
Fabulous.
And this is one measure that will serve to prevent that kind of activity, because each vessel knows, okay, I have 2 months that I can land 250,000 pounds, and it allows them to design their operation to meet that allowable catch level.
How does that compare to the other states?
Actually, they do not use this management tool. However, the Alaska Opelio fishery is going from this derby fishery that we were just speaking of next year to an IFQ system, which means that each vessel is going to be given a set amount of catch that it can land personally. For our purposes, that's too much for us to handle in terms of, you know, setting an allowable catch level per boat, plus we don't have the data to do it with. This is kind of an in-between I guess you could say, and again, this is very consistent with what we have going in our ground fish fisheries, our nearshore fisheries as well. We have 2-month limits on most mm-hmm. of the species.
Okay.
Incidental allowance. Pete described this a little bit. We are proposing to try to accommodate incidental landings of other species that might, other invertebrate species, other crabs that might be taken in conjunction with this fishery, up to a level of 5%. That would allow another king crab relative that was observed in the experimental fishery at a very low level. The observer program. Again, because this is a brand new commercial fishery that has yet to really demonstrate any sustainable history as a directed fishery, the department is very much in support of maintaining an onboard observer requirement. The experimental fishery we operated, he took an observer the first month of activity and then 25% of the times thereafter. We're proposing that each vessel that operates take an observer for the first 60 days of activity so that every vessel is taking an observer. We decided that 100% of observer coverage was probably more than we needed in terms of the data requirements, although you can see in some of the other fisheries elsewhere that they do require 100% observer coverage, like on catcher processor vessels, they require 100%, and then the experimental Tannerai fishery in Alaska, they require 100%. But we felt like our 60-day proposal would probably get us over 50% observer coverage. It's difficult to say how much we'll actually get. It really depends on how quickly the harvest level is taken and how many boats are participating. If it's all taken in the first 60 days, then we'll get 100% coverage.
And aren't we anticipating maybe 10 boats or something?
We're guessing 5 to 9.
Yeah, so we're not talking. Okay.
And that's based on phone calls, people expressing interest in this mm-hmm. fishery. And again, okay. We're expecting some interest from the boats from Alaska that might want to come down to participate with the IFQ program that's going on of their...
We have to put observers on them first.
Well, you know, everybody will be treated equally.
I know.
Yeah, but...
Sorry.
You know, we're thinking, I mean, because that fishery had 180 boats, and we're expecting a fair number of them to no longer participate in that fishery up there and to be looking for other opportunities elsewhere. We're proposing that the permit holder have the option of contracting either with a data collection firm that already is established. They send observers out. It's like a firm. Or they can contract individually with an observer themselves. And this would be funded by the permit holder themselves. There would not be any subsidization from the department or anywhere else. This would be all at their cost, which is, we're anticipating, in the neighborhood of about $300 a day. And so it's not cheap, but again, we're pretty, we feel pretty strongly that because this is a new fishery, and just for background, we don't have any other state program, observer program for any of our commercial fisheries. This will be the first one that we've actually established or required ourselves. The federal programs exist for the federally managed fisheries, but this will be our first. And since it is an emerging fishery, we feel pretty strongly that it's needed since we don't have prior catches and history in the fishery to rely on. Pete went over the size limit and the male-only fishery. Prohibition on the use of tanner crab as bait. This is just a measure that would help us make sure that we're getting the total catches that are actually taken, that we're getting them into the database and recorded. The permit fee. We're proposing a permit fee of $10,000, which is substantial in light of some of our other fees. But as you point out, we're expecting only 5 to 9 participants in this fishery. And the revenue will be used to offset the costs that have already been expended in developing the proposed fishery, as well as to fund the ongoing oversight of the observer program, as well as the logbook program, and ongoing review of the fishery data and any adjustment to the management measures as needed. I'd just like to spend a few minutes going over the proposed permit program, this handout here.
If I may, Marcy.
Please.
On the estimated cost chart, you show monitoring for an X amount of money, and that was just for the observer program and monitoring the logbook, and was not to collect any biological data?
Well, landing receipt information, no, the observer program will be funded by the cost paid by the permittee to the observer. But in terms of the department doing work of analyzing the data or
collecting
evaluating
biomass data.
I'm sorry?
Collecting biomass data.
At this point, we have not proposed to take on any fishery independent survey work in conjunction with this proposal. We do have the estimates coming in that we continue to monitor from National Marine Fisheries on the biomass from their ground fish survey work. So at this point, I would say no. I mean, there is no plan to undertake extensive independent work. Doesn't mean that we won't have our eyes open for additional opportunities to collect more information and possibly get more out of the existing programs that exist.
Quick thing,
yeah.
Just because my wheels are spinning. Do you have any idea how much Tanner crab is selling per pound right now?
It varies. I want to say, what, about $1.20, maybe less now?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
somewhere. I knew it was as low as 75 cents 6 months ago. I'm not sure what it is right now.
But they could still make a good living.
And the price does vary. It fluctuates. So do the other tanner crab fisheries. 75 cents.
$2 or $20 or, okay, thank you. Thanks.
Just to quickly go over how the permit strategy will work, the recommended harvest limit, we're expecting that with that limit, we said we're anticipating about 5 to 9 participants. It's really up to the individual fishermen to determine whether or not they want to buy into this opportunity to fish. It's not like some of our other permit programs that you've been accustomed to dealing with, moratorium fishery permit programs, limited entry programs. We aren't proposing to limit the sale of permits, which is quite different from other programs that we operate. And we're recommending this approach to let the market conditions, the profit margin, and the competition between the fishermen determine how many boats will be in this fishery. And that level can change year to year, and it's all based on their own personal ability to make a profit given the situations of the time and the other number of vessels they might be competing with. We just wanted to give you that as a little bit of background because it really, we believe, will allow us to focus more, instead of focusing our energy on the permit program itself. Instead, we can focus our time on the evaluation of the biological data that's coming in rather than dealing with a moratorium program. And again, because we have no prior history for this fishery, even if we wanted to develop a limited entry program, so to speak, it would be quite difficult because you don't have prior catches to rely on to make that determination of who might be in and who out. So that's what we're recommending for this program. It's quite different from many of the others that we've been in front of you with in the past. So with that, I think Maria has a few words to say about...
I have one question, Marcy. Yeah, over here.
Hi, I'm sorry.
Right in front of you. I thought I heard you say that the bycatch is about a million pounds or 2 million pounds. And I thought I heard you say that there would be a shift in the bycatch as a result of this industry or not. I mean,
no,
I'm a little confused there.
Okay, I'll try again. Right now, the groundfish landings, the trawl landings of Dover sole, thorny head, and sablefish, which are the deep water slope fisheries that are operating in this same area. If you look at the map, I passed out a map that has some little green squiggly lines on it that show the groundfish trawl areas and then the trap locations that occurred. So you can see the potential conflict that might arise over the use of these areas. Historically, the trawl fishery was operating at a much higher level in the 80s. They had the restrictions in place were not very restrictive. And now, in the 90s, 2000s, as a result of increasing management actions by the Pacific Fishery Management Council, those groundfish catches have gone down. They're about a quarter of what they were back in the 80s. Consequently, our estimate of the take of Tanner crab has gone down from about 5 million pounds in the 80s down to about 1.3 million pounds.
I think I got it now.
So,
so you're saying that this new commercial cast...
In the sense that now that same crab would be taken in traps. So.
This is like a three-ring circus here.
Yeah.
I sit on the Pacific Fishery Management Council for the director... of fish and game. And the Fishery Management Council, I'll talk a lot more about this afternoon when we get into some other agenda items, but they manage fisheries in federal waters. This fishery that we're proposing takes place 100% in federal waters. And the only authority that the state has is because the fishermen who want to participate in this fishery want to land their crab in the state of California. Because of that, and the fact that the federal government does not have a management plan for this species, we're able to do this. So that's as far as jurisdiction or where this fishery operates, it is totally a federal fishery. It takes place in federal waters. What happens when fishermen choose not to land their fish in the state, they essentially don't have to follow any of the regulations that we have on the books. Because this crab fishery in Alaska is being reduced, and there is interest being shown by some of those people to speculate on other fishing grounds, both Oregon and Washington have received requests for access to Tanner fisheries off of their states. What the state of Washington has said, absolutely not. We will not give any permits. We won't allow that fishery to take place off of our coast. Oregon, as Marcy told you, has a developmental fishery. We have been in contact and discussions with Oregon to let them know what we are proposing for the state of California. And we have had a discussion about the fact that this does take place in federal waters, and we have to be somewhat consistent in our management if we're really trying to establish a fishery that will be sustainable and one that we can monitor as a state. So we have informed the other states of what we are proposing. They are aware of all of the regulations that we're proposing. They will be considering additional or different possible restrictions on fishing in Oregon. And we're trying to take care of this at a state level and not have it be escalated into the federal arena, which then begins a very long and involved process for management. So I just wanted to give you that kind of bigger picture of where this fits. It's not like our typical fisheries that we deal with regularly in California. And as Marcy told you, this is the first time that we've had the opportunity to actually set out a fishery from the beginning not try and deal with issues after they've already been developing and going on for years and years, and trying to put Band-Aids on things that have blossomed into problems. So I think it's a rare opportunity that we have, and we have taken the extra time to try and look at this from a global perspective, more global perspective, rather than just someone coming in asking to go fishing.
Okay. Quick question. Mm-hmm. Because you just sort of mentioned the elephant in the room. I think this is, you know, good work and well thought out and practical and, you know, all and sustainable and all that. But I want to make sure I understand, if a massive Alaskan crab fleet decided to come down here and not land in California, and hypothetically they could scoop up the crab, go back to Alaska, and our folks would be standing there with a $10,000 permit without a crab. No, I understand. That's not in our jurisdiction. That's a big problem. In the real world, though, because that's the hypothetical paranoid person I am, but in the real world, would they do that? Would the crab all die before they got back to Alaska? I mean,
they processed them.
They couldn't. Thank you. Okay, see, so there is a catch there. That's why we don't want to go to federal, because Alaska's permitting process would cover that.
That's why we're trying to coordinate with the other states that there are some rules so that loophole isn't available to them.
I just want to make sure, because that just seems like it could be crab wars out there, you know. So. Okay.
And why did Washington deny, the state of Washington?
Their reason was they don't have staff to be able to do this.
Okay.
Definite reason.
And that was the only reason.
Right now, yeah.
Okay.
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 Great. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Good job.
Good job. Are there any other questions? Anyone else who want to speak to this issue? You can come up to the microphone.
And my name is Bob Osborne, United Anglers of Southern California. I say this fishery is occurring in an area where we really don't fish, and we really don't have an iron in the fire as far as the fishery or an opinion about the fishery or anything of that nature. I'd like to address my comments basically to the process and management concerns. And in looking at the presentation here, to have good management, you have to have good data. The data has to be, you know, itemized out to a degree that you could actually determine what the impacts of the fishery are, such stuff as bycatch and discards by specie in the fishery in relationship to the landed catch and information like that. And so from a data standpoint, from what I've seen here, you know, the data seems to be a little bit lacking in terms of, I'm sure it's available because they have an observer program actually out there counting every fish, or I assume they're counting every fish. And the second comment I'd like to make would be that on the observer program that they have in this thing, they talk about an observer program for the first 60 days. I think that's a great idea. I think there needs to be perhaps some sort of provision for a continuing observer program at some level, maybe to determine later, but you know, some sort of an assumption to start with that you're going to need to go out there every so often to monitor bycatch and the interactions that this fishery is going to have on some of these other stocks that are being taken by the trawl fleet and so forth. So I'd like to see a little bit more complete of a data set and some sort of provision to make sure that the data stays current over time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, I'm Paul Weakland. I have several comments since the observer thing was in the forefront. I'll start there.
Paul, hold the mic down so they can record you, please. Thanks.
Okay, I don't believe that this observer program would be necessary if you had licensed and permit fishermen instead of vessels. The big problem in our crab fishery today is that the illegal lawbreakers are insulated from any kind of real punishment. What you have is a fishery where the permit is attached to a boat, so that there are individuals that own many boats. In San Francisco, one individual owns seven crab permits, seven boats. He has up to 25 people working for him on his vessels. What happens is a crab fisherman is caught taking undersized crabs or female crabs, and you know, his mission is to get as many pounds on that boat as he can. If he can slip through some undersized ones and some female crabs, he'll do it because his permit, it's not his permit. He's just working on the boat. The permit is held by a guy sitting in an office building or some men's club at the Bohemian, and you know, he wants more crabs on my boat. Your job is to get as many pounds off that boat as you can. If you have to break them, go ahead. I'm sitting smoking cigars with my pals. I'm not going to get in trouble. They aren't going to take my permit. And when I do get caught, all I do is say, yeah, those guys are pirates. Get them off my boat. I don't want them on my boat anymore. I can get another crew tomorrow, no problem. And that's the biggest problem that you have with your crab fishery right now is insulation, and no one's accountable for the wrongdoing. Yeah, this fisherman will get a monetary fine. He might get his license suspended for a year. But that boat's back out crab fishing, and the same practices will be going on. That is the biggest problem with your crab fishery, no accountability. And the people that are running these boats have an incentive to break the law because they make more money, and the guy that owns a permit will never get it taken away from them.
Okay.
Now,
Mr.
the Observer program is not going to be
Mr. Wheatland, please. The boat owner, the permittee, is responsible for the actions of his crew.
But he's not required to be on the boat, sir.
He's not required to be on the vessel, but however, his permit can be taken away by the commission if there is violations on that vessel.
We've seen them many, many times. The person that committed the violation is the one that's punished, not the one that owns the permit. No. Your observer program would almost be not necessary. Besides, if I paid an observer, I'm going to want what I'm paying for, good observations. Now, if you have the permit owner on the vessel, you don't need an observer because he's there. Any wrongdoing, he could be personally responsible for. Simple process. The permit fee of $10,000 is way out of line. It is not fair or equitable. Trap limits don't work. They admitted that there are enforcement problems. Why continue with this problem? The other thing, total allowable catch. It's not used anywhere else, but it's being proposed here. We know that there's a fallacy in the total allowable catch, and it does not work. It's a failed concept. It is only a target level. It does not work as management. The time limit, soaking your traps. They say that there is no additional crabs that are going to be benefited from leaving your traps in the water longer. Any reasonable and prudent person realizes the longer you leave your traps in the water, the more opportunity for more crabs to go in the trap. This is a failed concept. Flawed also is the analysis of the chance of error, percentages of mistakes in their estimates. Pete Calvis, he was criticized for his inability to manage the sea urchin fishery. He failed there. None of his work in sea urchins was ever managed to pass peer review. Now he is being put in charge of the abalone draft, abalone plan. It says here that the abalone team, Mr. Calvis, does not have the ability.
Mr. Wheatland, we're not talking about abalone now.
We're talking about management, sir.
We're
management.
Talking about Tanner Crab. So,
and it says here that
Mr.
Wheatland does not have the level of ability to manage the resource. Now, if he cannot manage this resource that you put him in charge of, how is he going to be able to manage this one? Again, no percentage or margin of error in their surveys is presented. We've been told by the federal government that the average percentage of error is between 25 and 45% error on the surveys of the Department of Fish and Game.
Okay. One more point, and then we need to...
And the other thing, the woman said they use back averaging in their estimates. They back average to get their flawed.
Thank you, Mr. Wickman.
If I may just speak briefly on one point, thank you. Kate Wing with NRDC.
There you go.
Too early in the day still for complicated technology. Just briefly on the point about restricting the number of permits, I understand that the department feels that in order to set up a restricted access policy. They need to have a sense of how many people want to participate in the fishery. But I think that we are entering into a situation where you have a certain chicken and egg problem, in that once we try to set restricted access programs in place after fisheries have been in place for quite some time, we then find that it is extremely difficult to affect a number that is appropriate for the capacity of that fishery, because we have so many people who have been participating in it. And I think that it would be possible for the department to propose a limit that covers the number of permits that they are expecting to actually participate in this fishery. They say that they're expecting 5 to 9. They could set a permit level of 10 or maybe even 15 if they wanted, and that number of permits could be revisited on an annual schedule as far as a regulation for the emerging fishery before this fishery goes into a full FMP, which it will need to do if it's going to be going on a long-term basis. But if you're going to have people sort of dropping in to see how they like this fishery, moving in and out of Alaska, a type of situation where you might have a number of different individuals coming in, accumulating catch history, and then later you find out that the fishery can actually only accommodate a smaller number of boats, you're going to have to winnow that group down anyways. So if you start now by setting a certain maximum number of permits along with those restrictions, you might be setting yourself up better for a restricted access program in the future should this fishery prove to be profitable and something a lot of people want to participate in. Thanks.
Thanks,
something
Kate.
Something to think about.
Any other comments on this item?
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Sure. That was just the first agenda.
Yes, that's the first item, but we expected that to be long. Our next item is the sea urchin fishery and involvement. I'm not sure who's presenting this item. Okay.
Mr. Duffy.
Yay.
The return of Mr. Duffy.
You already have some of this.
Yeah.
This is actually a joint presentation by myself and Mr. Halme. Good morning, members of the Commission and Commission staff, and welcome to new Commissioner Gustafson.
Very good.
Good. During the late 1950s and into the 1960s, there arose an awareness in the minds of some that sea urchins had a negative impact on the regrowth and reestablishment of kelp beds in areas where warm water had reduced the standing stock of kelp, especially in Southern California. There was at least one government sponsored program, Los Angeles County's PERP, which was created to smash sea urchins along the shallow coastal waters to help restore declining kelp biomass. I actually participated in that program for a few days at one time. In the early 1970s, a small group of fishermen, aided by a scientist, Seuss Cato by name, from the National Marine Fisheries Service, applied to the commission for experimental gear permits to harvest red sea urchins, which would be processed to extract their roe, known as uni, for export to Japan for consumption in the sushi trade. The fishery took off rather rapidly, from a few hundred thousand pounds in the first year or two up into the millions of pounds, and topping 20 million pounds before 1980, almost all in Southern California. Around this time, a few far-sighted individuals began laying the groundwork for the future that we now know as co-management. In fact, one of those early thinkers is sitting right over here, Bruce Steele. The movement began within as divers first organized and saw the need to establish regulations for the orderly conduct of the fishery. Divers and processors together looked at permit numbers, fees, size limits, and open and closed fishing periods as possible management tools. The need was made even more evident as the fishery grew into Northern California and harvest moved quickly from the 25 million pound range to top out at about 52 million pounds in 1988. On the charts that I handed you, which are printouts from the department's website, I just want to caution you that Mr. Calvis is aware of this. There are 2 years that are missing from that chart between 1990 and 2004. It's not in that one.
Okay.
It's with that.
Okay.
And Mr. Calvis is taking steps to make that correction.
We wouldn't know unless you were showing us. You know, thank
That's
you.
Right. At the same time, the number of fishery participants was growing. The first sea urchin dive permits, and there were 212 in the first year, were issued in 1986. That was when the legislature made a formal permit. At the beginning of the 87-88 license year, the number of permits nearly doubled, and it was clear that there was a need to limit entry into the fishery. The then commission took emergency action to halt the issuance of permits, but the Office of Administrative Law rejected the emergency basis for the action. The commission then went ahead and did a normal rulemaking, which takes about 120 days, to establish a moratorium, but in the meantime, the number of permits had more than doubled from around 400 to 938. That same year, the industry sponsored legislation, and I say industry, that's the sea urchin industry, divers and processors working together, to establish an additional landing tax on sea urchins, initially in the amount of a half cent per pound. That tax was later raised to a full 1 cent per pound, and it was paid half and half by divers and processors for, and I use the about because I didn't have the exact years available to me at the time I wrote this up, but for about 14 years and totaled, again, about $3 million on about 420 million pounds of sea urchins that were landed during that time. The funds that were derived from that tax were used for sea urchin enhancement and management activities, as recommended by a director sea urchin advisory committee. That director sea urchin advisory committee, I worked for 10 years as the staff person to that group, and there were five divers, five processors, and a member from the Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program. The DSUAC was in existence for about 15 years and provided the department with invaluable cooperative effort in the management of the sea urchin fishery. Every regulatory change that came to the commission about sea urchins during that time had been discussed, and compromises were made before the hearings were held. You can imagine how smoothly that process worked compared to what some of you have to go through today. The landing tax is no longer being collected, as it lapsed after December 31, 2001. The old Director Sea Urchin Advisory Committee has been replaced with a Sea Urchin Fishery Advisory Committee, again with five divers and five processors members on that committee. The group is charged to recommend a wide range of projects, activities, and programs based on an ecosystem approach to sea urchin management to assure a sustainable sea urchin fishery. And that language is lifted directly from Section 8051.2 of the Code. Funding for these projects, activities, and programs are provided from the remaining balance of that additional fishery landing tax that was collected from about 87 through 2001. There currently remains approximately $170,000 in that. The account itself has over $200,000, but there's encumbrances on some of it. The Marine Life Management Act requires that a fishery management plan be prepared for all fisheries. To develop a sea urchin fishery management plan, data is needed on life history parameters, including rates of growth, natural and fishery mortality, settlement and recruitment, and an estimate of stock size. These data can then be used in fishery models to project future stock sizes and determine optimal harvest strategies. Because of the spatially variable nature of sea urchin populations, collecting these data requires extensive and fine-scale spatial sampling, which the department, unfortunately, is unable to manage with today's state budget realities. It was really rewarding to hear Commissioner Hattoy open the door with his comments about how do we get good data to manage fisheries earlier this morning. We'd like to provide an update on one activity that's being funded from the remaining balance of that landing tax, and that's the Barefoot Ecologist, or the BE program. The goal of that program is simply to harness the field expertise of the sea urchin diving community by training a cadre of sea urchin divers to collect fishery data on a daily basis to a standard of quality sufficient for management decisions, so that you won't have to ask that question of the sea urchin industry when they come before you, Mr. Hattoy.
I love the Barefoot College.
See, I'm almost barefoot today.
You're a TiVo ecologist.
And in the simplest terms, it means going to sea with the divers to show them the methods and processes that are used to collect a single density sample, which is sea urchins per unit area, and two test diameter measurement samples each day, along with a standard suite of information. In addition, the department is working with the industry to conduct cooperative surveys, which are done in the same location at the same time, to calibrate the data and to help provide the department with a measure of comfort in the divers' abilities to do this work. Mr. Halmay will now provide us with some highlights of the Barefoot Ecologist program and a preliminary report on some recent cooperative calibration survey work done in the Point Loma area at San Diego.
And that's it's funny you ask the term barefoot ecologist. It came from the term barefoot doctors in China. And what happened is they had the decision to make. There were sick people in the outlying villages, and they couldn't bring them into the central hospitals. So they grabbed one guy from each village, a bright young man, and they trained them to do medical stuff that you could do on site. And they became the barefoot doctors of China. So we stole that phrase and became the barefoot. Same idea. You don't have the expertise, the ivory tower pointy heads available all the time. So you're going to have to train.
Those are the pointy head ecologists.
Was that you?
Those are the pointy head ecologists. Yeah, PhDs.
So you're going to have to get them to train us. Instead of measuring sea urchins, they can show you how to measure sea urchins. The Barefoot Ecologist program, in its concept, we have 9 ports. There will be a barefoot ecologist in every port, and there'll be 50 to 100 data collectors. And so if you take this this pad out here that I have, and I'll go through page by page. Mostly it's a bunch of pictures that just jog my memory. First is just a picture of my boat and various other large vessels around me. I'm the smallest one there. It's an old man, and we can't even fill that up anymore. The first page is the protocols. After the report was written by Professor Hilborn and Jeremy Prince, we started the road to making protocols, and it's taken us over a year to develop these. The idea is it has to be able to be done by fishermen as part of their fishing operation, so you can't take hours to do it, but it has to be scientifically accepted. So we treaded that fine line, and we came up with all these measurements that we take. Some of them are fishery dependent, and some are fishery independent. We'll get into that. The next page will show you the measuring of the sea urchins aboard the back deck. They're put on the back deck, and the deckhand measures them. The next page shows you the form that each fisherman fills out. Each fisherman fills out the same form. This is on a computer program. There's about 8, 10, 15 pieces of data, including measurement of 30 urchins before the harvest and a sample of the 30 urchins harvested. So you have an idea of what was there before you harvested and what you took out. The next page shows the computer on a vessel. In San Diego now we have 4 boats with computers on their boat. They log the information. The computer is hooked up to the GPS. It's hooked up to the fathometer. So you have an ongoing record where he took it from. He can't cheat. And the data cannot be manipulated. It comes in exactly as it is. So after about almost a year of doing this type of work, Professor Hilborn came down to Santa Barbara, and we had a workshop. And two of the things that we talked about was, one thing was, what kind of model are you going to use this information in? Because you have to know how you're going to use it before you start collecting. This is the mistake with a lot of the data collection today. They collect a lot of data, and then 10 years later say, well, none of that is usable in these models. So he came in, and we came up, he explained the model that's going to be used for the stock dynamics. And he also explained another one, a real important part, which is the
part where we deal with the fishery dynamics. And he explained a method of agent-based modeling. So in fact, he models every boat as a separate agent in the fishery. He doesn't have boats going out and spreading themselves out properly, because boats don't do that. So he's taken, he will take every boat in the model and collect all the data about it. And so the second picture here is of, it wasn't enough that we have Professor Hilborn talking to a few leaders of the industry. He had to come to the picnic. He came to the picnic to talk to the 50 or 60 people. And we explained to him, he's from Washington. He thinks you stand on the table. We told him we eat off those tables, but in Washington, they're not used to that. The next page is a typical example of how we have to start with a fishery. That's the Port of Santa Barbara. There's a list of all the boats, all the divers, and now the barefoot ecologists will have to talk to each one and gather information about how they fish, where they fish, how big their boats are, and then we'll be able to model ideas like, if the weather is so-and-so, how many guys decide not to go to work? How many decide to go to the islands? How many decide to do certain things? And you'll be able to feed this back into the model of the fishery. And the second thing we talked about...
Do you have cooperation from the divers on this for the most part?
Yes, yes. Slowly. Sure. And again, that was the idea. Professor Hilborn came and had to explain to them, you need to go from data poor to data rich. If you go to data rich, it's going to be easy to have good management. If you don't have data, we heard this from Commissioner Hathaway, well, the less data you have, right. And for sea urchins, which is a patchy distributed thing, you can't just have one or two samples. You can't make one or two toes and estimate what it's like over the rest of the world. So you're going to have thousands and thousands of samples. For example, a fishing boat, normally it works somewhere around 100 days, works three dives a day, collects three sample sites, 300 sample sites in 1 year. Multiply that by 100. So now you have 30,000 sample sites. And you could harness that energy. That's the purpose. To be very honest with you, Commissioner Hathaway, it's not going as fast as I would like it. I expected this only to be a 10-year project, and now we're a year and a half into it, and we're already a year late, so it'll be an 11-year project is the way I envision it right now. The other thing at the workshop is we want to calibrate the data that we're collecting with the best possible data. So what we did was we took a section of the coast in San Diego that's this map right here. Those are the data points from one fishing vessel, and we selected a site 200 meters by 200 meters, somewhere in the middle of where we'd been fishing. And if you look at the next map, that's a blown-up section. We called farm. My biologist friend told me to start calling it gardens because he doesn't like the term farm. I went back to calling it farm anyhow. I like farm. And those are the data points, and those are the sections that we took. Now, we went into that 200-meter by 200-meter with the Fish and Game Department. They brought four biologists, and they ran 24 transects. And with the help of John Duffy and Dr. Streif Schroeder, one of the friendly pointy heads, he's actually kind of got a round head because he's been a good friend for 15 years. I kind of rounded the tips off a little bit over the years. We went out and spent 7 days sampling. We ran 10 200-meter transects and measured all the urchins along on the transects, counted. And we measured a few, yesterday, in fact, and the day before, I went in and did a regular harvest. So now we're going to have at least three things to compare. And the beauty of this is the last two pages are some of the preliminary printup of what we've been able to gather. In that area of 200 meter, 32% of the area sample had 90% of the urchins. It shows you the type of concentration there is. We sampled 15% in that scientifically designed method. And if you flip the page, is a beautiful rendition of the first one here is the scientifically defined. It gives you a density for that area, and that's a 95% confidence interval, very tiny confidence interval. If you only use two samples, you had that huge drag. It could be anywhere from -0.2, whatever that is. And then he did what they call bootstrapping. He ran it 1,000 times for different number of repetitions, and you see by the time we got to 11 repetitions, it was almost equivalent of the scientific. And that's the 11 repetitions of the scientific, of the protocols in the Barefoot Ecologist program. So once you have 10 or 11 of those dots in any one area, you're as good as doing a scientific measurement. And this is a dramatic, when I saw these a few days ago, it was really impressive how accurate these random transects are if you do enough of them. And we see that you don't have to do thousands of them to come up with something. And that's my take-home message is I remain a stakeholder. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, 1 minute. Mr. Duffy has to complete everything. I'm not finished. He's not finished.
And I just wanted to clarify that year and a half is not a year and a half full time. That's a year and a half part time, maybe with volunteer work and my paid time at 15 to 20% time.
Sure.
In closing, we would like to note that the sea urchin industry recognizes five areas of opportunity related to the regulatory process, and this is not today, it's over time in the future. The sea urchin fishing ground closures associated with the Marine Life Protection Act, which of course might come up in regulatory matters sooner. Open and closed days of the week for fishing, examination of the current capacity goal of 300 permits in the fishery, permit transferability, and local fishery management initiatives. We think that this Barefoot Ecologist program of data collection can provide valuable assistance with respect to these opportunities. And thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Any questions?
Thank you. Nice to meet you, too.
Good work. Really good work.
It's 10 minutes.
Good, guys. We can learn something from this.
Any comments from the public on this matter?
My name's Steve Schimmick. I'm with the Otter Project, and maybe these guys are saying, oh, my God, what's he going to say now? But I hope this day doesn't come back and haunt me. But I just want to say that SUHAC actually does a great job out there. You know, I've attended some of their Sea Grant meetings that were co-sponsored by the Sea Urchin Harvesters Association. They're progressive. They're smart. We don't always see the eye to eye, but that's okay. You know, Pete Halme even is on the Sea Otter Recovery Team, along with myself. I heard from him today that he might have to leave, but I hope he doesn't. These guys are good. And so that's an admission from one of the people that sometimes has to deal with them over difficult issues. So thanks.
Thank you for saying that.
Thank you.
Paul Weakland. I compliment all their efforts and goals, but also I'd like to remind them that no matter how good your data is, if you don't analyze it properly and misinterpret it, it's a failure. Now, I have investigated sea urchins for a long time, and I'm really into history, and I'd like to share with you a couple of things that I found out. Ms. Gustafson,
mm-hmm.
The mandible or the beak of the sea urchin has a specific name. If you're not aware of it, it's called Aristotle's lantern. This is because the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle studied urchins at great length, and he came up with his philosophy or idea of the fulcruming mechanism of displaced force from the fulcruming and mechanism of the urchin beak, and it's called Aristotle's lantern. Mm-hmm. Now, that's how long back the sea urchins started being investigated. Now, Socrates, another ancient Greek philosopher, also studied sea urchins. And Socrates was the first documented death associated with harvesting sea urchins. Socrates met his death while he was down at the beach harvesting sea urchins. Now, the one thing that Socrates mentioned was that he, in all of his experiments, was never able to crossbreed or interbreed the sea urchin, which he thought was fantastic and a species that he set higher above all the rest as being symmetrical and perfect. Now, the other thing about the otters. So we've been, you know, studying sea urchins clear back since ancient Greek times, and they still want to continue to study. And it seems that we restudy the same things over and over. Duplicate studies seem to be the norm. Now, the sea otter issue. I'm really into history. I look at the history. And I've gone around California, and I've studied greatly the history of California. And if you would go around like I do in the museums and the other state historical areas, one thing that is noticeably missing from all the archives and from the museums are any artifacts made by the native people out of sea otters. They utilized every species of every kind of animal, and artifacts are found for all of them in all of our museums except for sea otters. It's been misrepresented. The sea otters were never in great numbers along the California coast. Also, as evidence, you can check all the ancient ship logs. Sir Francis Drake in 1579, right on down the line, Vascano, Bodega, Bering, all of these people, Vancouver, that went up and down the California coast in the early days, they were meticulous in writing down every species they encountered, every organism. Strangely absent is any mention of large numbers of sea otters along the California coast. We have been duped. It's fraud that's been committed against the citizens saying that there were large numbers of sea otters. There is no archaeological evidence of that.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I just, I'll be brief.
Okay. Thanks.
But I have been at this for a long dang time. We've been diving since the early 70s. So from the time I was 19 years old until now that I'm gray, I've been picking sea urchins, and we've been involved in fishery politics for some of us for 25 years. And our industry is comprised of a lot of people that are pretty well educated because it's a job where you can go out and on that little boat that Pete showed you a picture, some people can make $100,000 a year if they apply themselves. And because of that, there's a lot of people that have degrees, they have good education, and they dive urchins because they can make better money. They're engineers, they're teachers, whatever, but they're urchin divers now. And we have, because of that, we have a great opportunity to use those people to do science for us. And for some of it's been kind of, it's not the most intellectually challenging job in the world going down picking urchins. We say it's glorified cotton picking, and it's just close to what it is. But it's something that, for whatever science we can do and whatever work we can do with fish and game, it has been somewhat of an intellectual challenge for some of us, or something that we can do. And we really do appreciate the work and the help that we've had out of people like Pete and John and everybody else at Fish and Game. If I had one lament, my lament is that the state is losing their biologists, and it's been going on for years. And from my perspective, you know, maybe I would have wanted to be a marine biologist. Well, I mean, our marine biologists, the people who had years and years at this, are losing their jobs, and that's my only lament. I mean, everything else I think's gone good with my fishery, but it really bothers me that fishing game is slowly but surely losing the, you know, great people, and there are people sitting around this room, and so that's all.
We couldn't agree with you more on that.
Share that concern, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, with that, we'll move on to the next item, which is update on the proposed changes to the commercial herring fishery.
Oh, that's going to be a long one.
It's
going to
be a long one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do a break first.
Did you want to take a quick break?
We were going to take a break at 12:30, but this is going to be a long one. This is going to take about an hour. So you want to do...
I will be real short.
You think?
I'm going to try.
Okay, let's do it.
I just asked him that. He said, no, keep going.
No, I thought we were going to... I'm sorry.
Okay.
You're the chair.
That's okay. I asked.
I thought we were going to do the Channel Islands thing.
Oh, I see. You're going to skip. Okay.
But I'm wrong. Let's move on. Let's do herring.
I misunderstood.
Yeah. Hey, John.
Let's see how quick he can be.
Well, there'll be other people, too, but it's okay. We can do this.
One thing, speaking of
losing biologists, one of the things I like about some of these meetings, they keep showing up. We had several former fish and game biologists show up today. It was kind of nice to see them all. I'll pick their brains for free later on. All right, I'm here to give an overview of the proposed regulatory changes to the Pacific herring commercial fishery. As you know, this is an issue not without its controversies. The summary of the proposed regulations are quotas. Humboldt Bay, Crescent City, Harbor will remain the same at 60 tons. Tomales Bay, we're proposing a 400-ton quota initially, with the consideration of possibly moving up to 500 tons based on whether we reach our biomass, spawning biomass by February 15th. San Francisco, we have provided, San Francisco Bay, we've provided two options, and it's in relative to quota, it's based on whether the commission prefers to go with existing mesh size or the 2-inch mesh size. If the commission goes with a no change in mesh size, the quota would be 5,890 tons, which is based on a 10% of the total biomass. Option two would be the quota if the commission chose to go with a 2-inch mesh size. That quota would be 4,500 tons approximately, which is about 7.6% of the estimated biomass. The reason for the smaller quota is because of interaction with younger age class fish, and it's just a little more conservative for that reason. Season dates are not proposed to be changed in Humboldt, Crescent City, or San Francisco. There is a proposal to change Tomales Bay that would essentially help coincide with beneficial tides. Tides are a big factor in Tomales Bay. Tides are important in all of them, but Tomales in particular. The other issue in Tomales is weekend fishing. There's a proposal. The herring fishermen are interested in fishing on weekends. That has been illegal because of concerns about interaction with the public, but during the wintertime, there aren't a whole lot of folks out there, so they were asking permission to fish on weekends. Our only consideration really there is costs, and we would be asking to recover our costs, and you'll hear, if not today, tomorrow, about why costs have become such a big issue for us. The other issue that you'll be addressing is reduction, of course, the 2-inch mesh size. I won't go into all the ad nauseum details unless you're particularly interested, and I'm sure some of the others here will bring it up. The mesh size is the issue. The commission, at one of your many meetings, asked us to come back and incorporate a 2-inch option in the environmental document, which we have, and in it lays out the pros and cons. If you're interested in all the details, I can provide that. But otherwise, there are a few other miscellaneous bits and pieces. Gillnet length measurement, you'll remember at your Monterey meeting, in the parking lot, we resolved how to measure the length of a net. We think that's worked out really well. The cork length issue. Other one, we're no longer certifying nets. Okay. It turned out to be very difficult and expensive.
Yep.
And then the other item is a transfer fee reduction. As you remember, there was discussions about making the transfer fee more palatable, although you will also hear from me, I hate passing up on getting more money. We need it. CEQA, again, we have received no comments on the CEQA document to date. There are some minor changes being incorporated into the draft. The other item to give you fair warning, and you'll hear more about this elsewhere throughout the meeting tomorrow and Friday, is we are seriously short-staffed in many areas, and the herring staff is one that's very short-staffed right now, which is going to complicate things. The other issue you may hear about is if you go to the 2-inch net mesh size, you're probably going to hear from the roundhaul fleet, because that apparently was the size they used to use, so they may want back in the fishery. That's another issue that by going to smaller mesh size, you may have those folks interested in reentering. The take-home, I do need to leave you with one take-home message on the mesh size. You've heard lots of discussion about this. We want to emphasize that we still have concerns about going to a smaller mesh size, but as you requested, it's built in there with the pros and cons, and we did adjust the quota to allow for some of our concerns of going to smaller. So you have a full suite of options. Are there any specific questions you have?
tomorrow right. We'll hear from anybody, and it's mostly about mesh size.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, is there anyone who would like to address us on that issue? Okay. Didn't see you getting up there, sir. Sorry.
Sam Liberati, I'm a herring fisherman. Zonkey just talked about two options on the fishery, 2-inch mesh or 2 1/8. Last year, you know, two times the commission voted and established that 2-inch mesh is the right mesh to use in a herring fishery. And we also stated that if we stayed with the 2 1/8, there's no way we're going to catch a quota. So the option that's presented here of 10% of the quota basically with 2 1/8, it don't matter if it was 50%. We're not going to catch a fish with 2 1/8-inch mesh. It's just not possible. It's too big. And I don't want to go into all the details on that. I'm sure you guys heard enough of that stuff.
Many times.
But I'm real concerned because statements being made like if we get 2-inch mesh, then the round haulers are going to want to come in. And that doesn't make any sense at all because the round haulers fish with inch and an eighth, inch and a quarter. I'm not going to give you sizes, but if you looked at their fish, when they were fishing, they're about this big. There is no way in the world that we could catch those fish with 2-inch. And I'd also like to remind the commission that 2-inch mesh was used before. And I don't ever remember a 2 or 2 1/16 ever catching trout or anything but herring. So I just wanted to make those points clear to you. Thank you.
And under the proposal from the alternative from the department, if the commission decided to go with the 2-inch mesh, do you think the fishery folks can live with the quota they're recommending?
I'm sorry, I don't hear very well.
There's two different proposals, the size and the amount.
Yeah.
And if we go with the 2-inch mesh size, are you okay with the amount they're saying you can catch? I mean, do you think you can operate under that?
I don't think the amount of the quota they're talking about with 2-inch mesh is correct.
Okay.
Because I think we made this point last year that the herring fishery should be controlled by the quota, not by trying to filter fish through nets.
Yeah. We've gone, yeah, but okay.
Thank you.
I heard you. Okay, thank you.
I'm Matt Ryan. I'm on the Director's Herring Advisory Committee. These are 30 years of...
No, I'm laughing. I know this.
Yeah. But you can see that the age structure hasn't really changed. They're talking about... This chart, it's from Canada. There's 5 different statistical areas. It's a bubble chart that shows the age structure of the Canadian fisheries over 50 years. And as you can see, there's no herring population that has an age structure that's stable, where you have almost every fishery is carried by young fish, just like San Francisco. And Fish and Game's whole premise of trying to... They give you a net that only catches older fish, and then they tell you the fishery's in trouble because there's no old fish. I mean, it doesn't even make sense. And I think with as far as the CEQA document, there's several things we have. In there, they state that they're not subject to the Marine Life Management Act, and that's not true. The Marine Life Management Act states that all fisheries that were under the commission's control before 1999 are subject to those laws, yet they say right in the CEQA that this doesn't apply to us. The Director's Advisory Committee is it says that they're supposed to present management recommendations to us at the meeting. They don't. They've changed the wording in the CEQA document instead of present to discuss, and they didn't either. Mm-hmm. We didn't, you know, when we saw that they refused, we asked to see this document before it was presented. They refused to let us see it. It's they've thwarted the whole process. They continue. It's not, none of it's truthful. It's the CEQA document's propaganda. I guess that's all.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, so we'd like to take about a 15-minute break, and then we'll reconvene. Thank you. Hadn't eaten since early this morning. We're going to resume the meeting with item number 5 on our agenda, which is the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary. And I'm not sure who's presenting. Oh, Maria, thank you.
I'm going to be handing out a couple of things. One is a booklet that the Pacific Fishery Management Council has put together, very general overview, basic introduction to navigating the council process. So I'm going to give you the stack of these. I would hope that all the commissioners would get a copy at least tomorrow. And then I have a package of background information that we'll work from for the discussion on this issue.
Thanks. Understanding the council process, boy. Magic.
And there's some extras here for
public. No, it doesn't say understanding, it says navigating.
Navigating.
Yes.
Unlike the past few discussions this morning, this one is going to involve lots of process. And federal process, which is even more daunting and convoluted than state process. So don't expect any pretty pictures or history lessons. My understanding of this agenda item springs from council action taken in the June meeting to establish some marine protected areas at the Channel in the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, and the apparent confusion over how that decision could have happened at that meeting, and evidently the commission feels that it was not apprised of what was going on at the council relative to establishing MPAs. So,
That's almost what happened. What happened is, you're absolutely correct. The June meeting took place. Information started coming back to various commissioners. I got calls from certain environmental groups that were concerned that the department took a position on artificial reefs with, you know, leaving offshore oil rigs out there. Then some fishermen got concerned about no-take zones, and then Mr. Rogers got involved, and he asked for this agenda item, because what he said was not whether or not we did the wrong thing or the right thing, but how do we do these things, and, you know, and how are we involved in the process, and if the public thinks that it was something else, you know, how do we mitigate that, if we can? And so I just want to make sure it wasn't like a challenge to you. Mm-hmm. It was sort of just that we needed to understand what the heck was happening, because we're not always the smartest. Thanks.
And I think I am trying to approach that with this information.
I just didn't want any disrespect going to you.
Sure. Okay. Thanks. Just to start history there, when I said I wasn't going to give history, the commission did make a decision in 2003 relative to establishing MPAs in the sanctuary. That was policy for the department, giving the department direction. We did come to you with regulations to establish those in state waters, and the expectation that was expressed with that decision is that the federal complementary MPAs would be soon to follow in federal waters. So that was the history on the policy portion of that. In the packet that I've given you, the first page explains the two authorities under which the Pacific Fishery Management Council can consider establishing marine protected areas in federal waters. And basically, the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act deals with the authority to control fishing. Under the National Marine Sanctuaries Act, you'll see that the authority there and the objective of that authority is to protect marine resources and historical vessels or unique habitats. So the two authorities are very different in what the objective is. However, they both work in concert, or could, to get to the same end result. Now, the second page is maybe a clarification of what can be considered by a lot of us a very confusing time at the council. We have two authorities, and currently the council is engaged in considering establishing MPAs at the Channel Islands under the National Sanctuaries Act. That is an item that has been on the agenda for several years. It is an agenda item in our September meeting coming up, where we will have the opportunity of designing regulations that we will recommend be implemented under Sanctuaries Act. So you see the council at the bottom, the two authorities, and where those authorities flow through. On the left, the Magnuson-Stevens fishing issues in the National Marine Fisheries Service. On the right, the Reserve Sanctuary Program. They all come together at the top under NOAA, which is the umbrella agency for both of those groups, and the decision is made at the Department of Commerce. The third page is taken from the council's website, and it is the reserve's timeline, and this is reserves in the broadest sense. The council was taking this up in spring of 1999 of what is this reserve, can it be used as a management tool for fisheries? Is this something the council wants to even contemplate when we establish management measures? That process began back in 99. The items on your timeline that are in orange are the activities that took place specifically relative to the Channel Islands under sanctuary. At the time, the first part wasn't under any authority. It was just what do they want to do? How do we do this? I'll probably come back to this page when we start talking about what actually happens, what's available. The fourth page is the council's list of objectives or goals for establishing marine reserves. And there are six of them, and they're in priority order in this list. And you see that it focuses primarily, the first one there is on fish stocks. But you do see that there is biological productivity, which is generic. Number four, the providing protection for the resources for uncertainty. Habitat protection is number five, and research and education is number six. When you look at the list of objectives, they're not far from the kinds of objectives that are contained under the National Sanctuaries, Marine Sanctuaries Act. A lot of the same. So now I'm going to get into a little bit of the process that has been going on at the council. The page that has some green highlights is about the documents, the amendment to the groundfish plan that deals with essential fish habitat. So now we're not talking about fish stocks, we're talking about habitat. The Council of National Marine Fisheries was in, let's see, what are they, a defendant, I guess. They were in a lawsuit back before 2002 that showed that management of habitats for groundfish was deficient or possibly deficient, and that the council needed to consider a process that would be looking at whether the essential fish habitat that they had established was adequate and whether there were any issues about impacts to habitat that needed to be addressed that they hadn't addressed in the past. And that's what began this risk assessment or process that looked at, do we need to do something different than is currently being done? Are there changes that need to be made? And what kind of information might we have available to us to even consider any changes? So that took place for an entire year. And in August of 2004, the council determined that, yes, there was sufficient information, there were habitat issues that needed to be addressed, and we embarked upon an amendment. In drafting the environmental impact statements for the council for an amendment process or consideration for amending, ranges of alternatives are presented to the public to consider. The essential fish habitat document dealt with three separate issues. One was establishing essential fish habitat and describing that. The second item that was under consideration was, were there any habitats that needed to be designated as habitat areas of particular concern? And the third part of the document dealt with, are there any management measures that need to be adopted that would minimize impacts to habitat? So the document itself was three-parted, nested in some cases, and within each of those areas, the public was given a range of possible actions that the council could undertake. The focus for a lot of the discussions relative to this essential fish habitat document was on the trawl fishery, which was pretty extensive along the Pacific coast for many years, and as Marcy told you earlier this morning, has been reduced significantly in the last 10. But it still exists, and it accesses a lot of different types of habitat, from nearshore, sandy, muddy habitat to, in the past, very rocky, high relief habitat. So that was the gear that was focused on primarily in this document to consider management measures that might minimize the impact of that gear on habitats. However, the document did contain the range from essentially doing very little to fishing, managing fishing gear and habitat interactions, to the other extreme, which was pretty much closing large areas to fishing. And within that particular option, the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary was identified as an area that could be closed totally to any kind of fishing opportunity. In June, where decision was made as to what the council was going to recommend to National Marine Fisheries Service that they develop regulations for, there was quite a bit of discussion for the day that we made the decision. About a week before the decision, about a week before any council meeting, the department holds a conference call with individuals who have shown a willingness and an interest in council activities. They show up to the meetings. They're on some advisory panels. They play a role in providing California with input. We also get back from them ideas on what they would prefer to see in management measures. On that phone call, at the time that I had the phone call, I did indicate that we were considering, we being the state, we're considering designating the identified federal MPAs that the commission expected back in 2003 to be designated as habitat areas of particular concern. And looking at that as possibly, because the decision on where to put those reserves was based on habitat in a lot of respects, this looked like an appropriate place to deal with that and say that these might be areas that we want to spend a little bit more effort on. In the week that transpired between that phone call and the actual decision at the council, there were discussions about is there a possibility of just going ahead and recommending that the council establish these federal reserves under this habitat document, and then that would also mean that any of the authority would be through the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Prior to June, the council had discussed the issue of establishing reserves under the Sanctuaries Act or Magnuson-Stevens Act, and they had made it very clear to the sanctuaries that have come to the meeting that the preference was for the Magnuson-Stevens Act to be the authority under which those reserves might be implemented. So they had already given an indication that that's what they wanted to do. Since the commission had given the department the policy of what to do, it just kind of came together during that week at the council meeting of, well, maybe this should be part of what California recommends for habitat issues along the coast, part of what we recommended. So that was decided a day or two before, when we got to the council meeting. And the morning of the council meeting, we hold a public briefing before the council starts to kind of go through the agenda for the day, talk about issues that we're going to discuss, talk about positions that the state might be taking, listen to comments from representatives of the advisory committees, have the public who are in attendance give us some insight on what they've heard in the halls and discussed. So it's kind of a briefing, and at that meeting I did let everyone know that later on in the afternoon that would be part of what California would be recommending be part of a motion for the council to consider. So when we get to an agenda item at the council, just like your commission meetings, we have presentations, and then we have public comment, and then council discussion and on a motion, and then the vote is taken. So there was the public comment opportunity. Some of the environmental community did make comments on that particular portion of the proposal. And the vote adopted. The vote went favorably for the option that was put on the table. And now I switch to what's coming up in that green paper, September. We will be reviewing the actual regulatory language that would implement this through the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And then adopt in November those regulations that would then go to NOAA or NMFS. NMFS then does its own review, has public comment period, public comment opportunities when they publish in the Federal Register, and the decision by the Secretary of Commerce is expected next February. It would be implemented in May. The Secretary has the opportunity to approve the entire document, to disapprove the document, or to approve only portions of the document. And the Secretary has done that in the past with other amendments that the Council has adopted, most recently for our highly migratory species fishery management plan. So that is a possibility. So under Magnuson-Stevens, that's the how things played out and how things will play out for the next few months. Now we'll go to the last page. Last page talks about the process under the Sanctuaries Act. And this, these last two pages relate back to that graphic, I think, on the second page where it shows the two authorities. These things are kind of happening simultaneously, which creates confusion for people. One of the requirements under the Sanctuaries Act is that the councils are given an opportunity to make these regulations for them, but they will be promulgated and implemented through the Sanctuaries Act. The sanctuaries themselves do not necessarily have the authority to manage fisheries. Depends on the designation documents that are when the sanctuaries were established, essentially, you know, their charter of what they could do and what they couldn't do. The Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary does not have the authority within their designation documents to regulate fishing. So that's why they come to the council. They say, you're the fishery regulators in federal waters. You guys make up the regulations. So that is the parallel system that's taking place currently. And as I said, in September, the council will have the opportunity to adopt some regulations. I'm unclear whether the council will adopt regulations. There will certainly be presentation and discussion and comments by our advisory committees and public comment. The council is under a timeline relative to the Sanctuaries Act for establishing reserves. We have until the end of November to provide the sanctuary with regulations. So the September meeting is going to be a kind of first decision, and then in November we have the opportunity to finalize any regulations that would be recommended under the Sanctuaries Act. What's going on now is there's not a concerted or definite answer from NOAA as to which authorities these reserves should be promulgated under. And that is why they're kind of on two tracks. There is the hope that there will be some decision that, yes, these reserves should be under Sanctuaries Act authority, or no, a combination of Sanctuary Act, Magnuson-Stevens, and state regulations for those fisheries that the state manages would be adequate to reach the goals that the sanctuary has for the establishment of these particular reserves. So there's kind of like three layers of activity going on, and there's no clear answer yet as to how that final action might play out. And so we're kind of on two tracks. For the state of California, from Secretary Chrisman, his expectation is that this goes forward under Magnuson-Stevens, and they regulate the fishing portions of it. And if the state has fisheries that the feds don't manage, then we would find ways to manage fishing activity in these areas. And then the sanctuary would promulgate regulations that would take care of things like drilling and dredging and touching archaeological artifacts, those kinds of authorities that neither the department nor the Pacific Fishery Management Council currently have. So that's it in a nutshell. And please, I'd like to discuss any or clarify anything that you might still need clarification on.
Great, thank you. Commissioner Hattori, this is all new to me. You asked, I think the commissioner is asked to bring this back.
Yeah, I'm pretty comfortable with all this. Whether individual people agree with what decisions were made, they had adequate opportunity to make their case. Sometimes we make our case and we're not agreed with, so we think we're not heard, which isn't the case, it's just we're not agreed with. So I think when I'm looking at this, I could make some changes, but I'm not the Secretary of Commerce or the Director of NOAA, so I don't have the right to, but I think regulating fishing clearly goes under Magnuson, and regulating sanctuary clearly under sanctuary, and where the state overlaps, we overlap. I don't think you did any midnight raid on the council to surprise anybody. I know I voted for, the authority for the department to go to, and I know that was a controversial vote. That was 2-1, wasn't it? And I know a lot of people disagree with it. I know we also promised the public that they would have more time to make their case before a decision was made. I'm looking at that now and thinking maybe because we were trying to act in such a fair and accommodating way, we really didn't have the authority to say to the public we were going to give them more time to do it because the Pacific Council had the authority to do this, even though we said people would be heard again and again on this. The council still took its process to the next step. I know that there's some hard feelings out there, and I want to say that I care about people who have hard feelings. I don't know what else can be said other than I see the law having been followed. I see public comment opportunity to have been adequate, and I guess it's just what democracy looks like sometimes. Like sausage, you don't want to watch it being made, and that's where we are.
Well, and I'd like to just say that in defense of the confusion, defense of the comments, I guess that there wasn't enough public comment or there wasn't enough heads up that this would be taking place. It is confusing. It is a lot of issues going on at the council during the week. As I said, the focus of this document was for many people on the trawl fishery.
Right.
And some of the other stuff that was in there and the possibilities that were in there were really not brought up into the spotlight. Things at the council, developments of management options happen rapidly sometimes, and it's very difficult to be able to have this stuff months in advance to be able to provide the public that extra opportunity. So I'm aware of that. I try hard to do that as often as possible. This was just an opportunity that it wasn't, we just couldn't afford that at the time. It literally happened the day before the agenda item. And it was of no plan that it happened that way. That's just the way it happened.
And we already had a position established.
Right. And that's the position I was taking there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other comments from the public? Anybody want to comment on this issue?
Let's not go on forever here. Yeah. Actually, you know what? Yeah. The commission agenda tomorrow, it's on the agenda.
Yes.
And that's right. Why we don't want to do comments now and then comments then, because at the Marine Subcommittee meetings, I've just been told this, it's not normally an official hearing noticed and commented on. So we're not quieting you down. We're just saying this fabulous presentation you're about to make to turn our minds around should take place tomorrow. I mean, unless you want to do it today and make me hear it again tomorrow.
Well, let me say something that, since I've attended every Marine Subcommittee, we do have public dialogue with the commission.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay.
It's in an informal setting, and...
Well, this looks like a formal thing. That's okay.
This is the first time it's videotaped.
Because we have speakers and videos. I just wanted to make sure we're doing things legal. I'm not a lawyer. Go ahead.
We used to sit around a table, and it was a lot easier like that. You could kind of kick things around.
I'm not shutting you up, Tom. I promise you I would never do that. You would kill me.
No.
Go ahead.
Bobby wouldn't want to do that.
Okay.
I'd like to commend the department for the presentation. I think it was very, very good. It really covers a lot of the bases. I think the only problem I have is it probably should have been done a year ago. The decision on the Channel Islands was made, as you well know, in 2002. I think our problem is this is the first time we've seen this decision in light of essential fish habitat. We've worked on essential fish habitat in regarding trawls, regarding destructive fishing gear. The entire process revolved around destructive fishing gear. That was all the science that was ever presented on removal of fishing areas was because of destructive fishing gear. And the Channel Islands process, as close as we can see, never really showed up in the debates. I don't think we've ever seen it in front of the commission. And this really, it opens up a couple of questions for us. I mean, the issues we have are, these are essentially new closures that are put in place in the Channel Islands, actually in federal waters, outside of state waters, in the name of essential fish habitat. This wasn't done in partnership with the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, where we had this entire process before. This was done outside the purview of the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary. They actually seemed surprised at the time when this came forward. This was done outside the Marine Life Protection Act process. And again, I've got the figures and I'll bring them up tomorrow. The state has spent millions of dollars getting the public invested in a public process so that when you have this, the stakeholders know what's going on. And what this did is by moving this outside the process, you cut the legs out from under the process. You're basically wasting away millions of dollars and goodwill by getting stakeholders involved in the process when this happens at the 11th hour. And I think the most important thing I've got to say is this decision, as close as we can see, was not made by you people. This was not made by the California Fish and Game Commission. So if it wasn't made by the California Fish and Game Commission, and you manage the Department of Fish and Game, essentially, I mean, we take a look at the law, where was this decision made, and why was it made at this point, and why was this other vehicle called in? Like I said, I think it was a great proposal and a really great presentation by the Department of Fish and Game. But we really have got to get the house in order. Who sets policy for the state of California for our resources? And that is the bottom question here. It's not about the Channel Islands closures. It's about who sets policy and how is it done. We believe that you guys do a very good job, you guys and gals, do a very good job. You have an open, straightforward, transparent process. That's where policy should be set in the state of California. Thank you.
Mean to cut in line. I apologize because I wasn't at the Bishop meeting, and so I didn't hear the original discussion in which this came forth. And of course, you know, we have great respect for the folks at United Anglers. We've worked with them on a lot of issues, and I think our organization certainly would agree that a review of department and commission policies and procedures is probably warranted by the stakeholders, and we'll talk more on that tomorrow. But since I didn't hear the original presentation at Bishop, I'd just like to give our perspective as people who were also involved in the essential fish habitat process for, you know, since the essential fish habitat provisions were enacted in Magnuson-Stevens in 1996. So this situation that occurred at the council, I guess, to me, we're somewhat confused that people seem surprised by it. But as you heard from Maria's presentation, there is extensive public comment opportunity available at the council process and throughout the council process. Many of us here sit on those advisory panels, participate in those calls. And when the EFH process came forward, everybody had the opportunity to look at what was on the table. And what was on the table was everything from closing the entire coast to trawling to closing nothing. When you do an EIS, you have to bound it with those bounds. So everything was on the table, including the Channel Islands. We had multiple meetings with Secretary Chrisman, Mr. Mastrup, Mr. Broderick about how the state was going to go forward and implement the commission's policy directive, which was to create marine protected areas in the sanctuary waters, and that includes federal waters. Now, the federal government is sort of free to pursue however under its laws it wants to make the commission's policy recommendation a reality in the waters from 3 to 6 miles. And NOAA has two branches that are fighting it out amongst themselves over who gets to be lord and master of the waters between 3 to 6 miles in the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary. And if the commission wants to get involved in minute interpretations of statutory authority over that kind of competition, then I suppose the commission is welcome to get involved with that. But my understanding of the vote on the commission's part was that there had been a public process. There was a public process in the Channel Islands that went on for a long time. And it said, you're going to create these marine protected areas within the sanctuary. The state will do its part, and then the feds will do their part. And what happened under essential fish habitat is the feds doing their part under one of the authorities available to them to do that part. And was it a complete surprise to people exactly how it went down at the council? Maybe a little bit, but that is inherent in the council process. I think there are many in the environmental community who were surprised that the state supported designating oil rigs as habitat areas of particular concern, but I don't hear many other folks in this audience coming forward to complain about that decision, perhaps because that's a decision they support. So I think the issue here is as what was brought up before, it's a very transparent process. It's a very public process, not just here, but at the federal level. And in terms of how the commission's policies are carried out at the federal level, that's something for the federal regulators to determine amongst themselves. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kate.
Again, I'm Jim Martin, and I'm with the Recreational Fishing Alliance. I also serve on the Groundfish Advisory Panel to the PFMC. And so I spent about 40 hours of my time dealing with the essential fishery habitat decisions, and I think it's important to realize that this is an amendment to a groundfish plan, essentially. And my question then and now is how we can talk about no-take reserves under the provisions of a groundfish plan. And there was no discussion in the highly migratory subcommittee about this. I felt completely out of the loop. We never had a lot of this stuff brought up in the GAP meetings that I attended. And, I understand why the department took the decision it took. But, and I also understood, was very aware that this was not just about trawling, that there's a lot of these areas have been set aside and all kinds of fishing regulations can be made within those areas. And it was done solely for trawling. The trawlers and the enviros got together and worked out what areas were going to be considered habitat areas of particular concern. And whether that's going to work for us as recreational fishermen, I don't know in the future. So that's my comment.
Paul Weakland. I have a long list of questions that I've been asking for over 10 years about the marine protected areas. No fishing zones. Still, we have had no answers.
I'm not sure, Mr. Weakland, that this is the forum to bring those forward. If you want to give those to the department in writing, I'm sure.
I've already done that.
Okay. Many times.
Already been done many times.
Oh, okay.
Many times. Now, why punish fishermen for failed management? The fishermen in the state of California only fish under permit and regulations set down by the state of California. Now, if we're fishing by regulation and statute, and now you deem that our fishing is inappropriate, who is responsible for setting these rules and regulations for fishing? I believe there's a lot of hypocrisy going on here. How does closing an area to fishing or a marine protected area protect the resource from oil spills, pollution, urban agricultural runoff? It does not. How does closing an area to fishing protect from failed federal policies like the overpopulation of seals and sea lions? Now, when I was a kid growing up in California, seals and sea lions are pretty rare. You'd run and go look at one. Well, now we have an overpopulation. There's so many, they're dying because there's not enough resource and areas for them on the beach. The small pups are being crushed because there's so many on the beaches that they're dying. And what about failed federal policy of zonal management for otters? Doesn't this otters outside their zonal management area show that zonal management is a failure? Yes, it does. Habitat destruction. Now, we heard that these trawlers are destroying the habitat. Well, they're gone. These habitat destroyers are over. They're already out of the fisheries. How can you use this as an excuse to punish fishermen? How does the construction of plants like Diablo Canyon, military operations, how does San Onofre, how does that, you know, why are fishermen being punished for this? Global sonar, fishery management. Poaching and illegal take, mismanagement. How can fishermen be punished for this? The introduction of disease like withering syndrome and parasites like the cebellid worm. Unethical researchers and grant-sucking parasites that have a vested interest and a hidden agenda for these closed areas. Failed leadership, failed stewardship. How does closing an area to fishing prevent this? How does closing an area to fishing prevent migratory species, finfish that swim away? It's illogical. The whole concept is flawed.
Mr. Weakland, do you have a closing comment?
Why punish fishermen for the absence of management, illegal take, a lack of enforcement? This is a flawed concept. It is not advertised in a way or method. There are no criteria for failure. There is no criteria for failure of this project. There shows hypocrisy right there.
Okay. Thank you for your comments.
And now we'll do this again today, tomorrow, right? Again tomorrow.
Hopefully we won't.
Shows the hypocrisy of the subcommittee
Hopefully
meeting that was supposedly destroyed. Now we'll bring it back.
My name is Bob Osborne with United Anglers of Southern California. I'm a member of the Highly Migratory Species Advisory Panel at the Pacific Fishery Management Council, and we actually had an advisory meeting on Tuesday before this decision was made, and there was no discussion of it at that meeting, even though it affects our fisheries. And as Jim Martin pointed out, he's on the GAP. The GAP is the advisory council for the groundfish to the council also. There's a long tradition of actually delaying decisions if the GAP and their appropriate advisory committees have not had a chance to put their input into something that's brought before the council. And so while we have a great deal of concern about it, it seems to be looking at this, there's apparent some maybe extenuating circumstances here or something of that nature. But even as a member of the Highly Migratory Species Advisory Panel, I don't get my travel paid for going on groundfish issues, but United Anglers actually supported me to attend, literally dozens of meetings related to this EFH over a long period of time. And there was never any discussion about doing Channel Islands under that EFH proposal. So, it's a rather difficult situation, for the public, which it doesn't really understand what's happening here. All of a sudden, there's a tremendous amount of discussion about all the other management measures that came into the EFH. And so that's all I had to say about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments?
No, tomorrow I know that there's a number of commissioners that have comments, suggestions, and all kind of things. So tomorrow we'll actually engage a little. So I don't want you to think it was going in one ear and out the other. Okay, thanks.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, I think we covered item number 6 during that discussion, yeah. So we'll move on to item 7. And Department of Fish and Game, how can you improve the usefulness value of future subcommittee meetings? It sounds like we have a whole team that are going to help us.
Additional handout
Oh, I'm sorry, Maria. Did you want? Did you have a?
Oh yeah, but I thought you covered that.
We thought you covered the
timeline. Oh, you have a whole other presentation. Oh my God!
Oh,
great.
I
understood the process timelines.
Well,
meaning it's a complicated.
Okay, we'll
process
go back to item six.
And, you know.
Sorry,
that's okay.
Do you have your 2 o'clock cutoff?
2:30.
Okay, so I can try and do this. Handouts.
Complicated handouts. Handouts that only Maria could.
We need one more up here.
No.
Okay. Because there was several issues relative to the council and Commissioner Gustafson, you've just come on to this and been hit with council and PFMC and you know.
Acronyms,
out of the blue.
Lots of new acronyms.
Right. I thought that I would take the opportunity to give you a little bit of background perspective on how the council operates. And what's on the first two pages really represents an entire year at the council meeting. I think it begins in April of 2004 on that particular thing. And it's a planning tool that we use at the council at the end of the week to plan what we're going to do in the next few months so that people have a heads up of issues we're going to be dealing with. And they're organized under subject matter. And so I just thought that you could have the whole picture of what the council deals with in a council meeting and how things progress during the year to final completion. The way that the schedule often works is salmon issues are taken up in the spring. And groundfish used to be taken up only in the winter, and now we do it all year long. So it has now become an agenda item every time we get together. On the third page, I guess, I'm going to focus on the two other handouts I have in there. Focus on the items where the commission has indicated an interest in the past to provide the department with policy guidance before the department goes to the council meeting. And the first one is about salmon. And this is for the 2006 salmon process coming up. And I tried to narrow down to the most important items that would give you information and show you where your guidance might be useful or the timing of that guidance. So the 20th of January or the third week of January, we get some indication as to what the status of the Klamath Falls Chinook abundance might be relative to this year and past years. It's a kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down. It looks better, it looks worse. And then not until the middle of February do we actually get the numbers for what the abundance is going to be. So there's a very small window in there of having the information that we can provide to you so that you can make a decision to give us guidance. It's a tight time frame. And then the council meets in March and adopts a range of regulatory options that they'll finalize in April. So that's a very tight turnaround there also. So I guess on the next page is what I propose some ideas on where the commission might insert itself. And this is primarily dealing with the issue of what should be the proportion of the fall Chinook that should go to the in-river fishery, a very contentious discussion we had last year. This is not something that has to happen each year. It's not an expectation that we would be coming to you for guidance. This is totally on your desire to involve yourselves in giving us any guidance that's different than what you've given us the prior year. Okay? So if you choose to give us guidance, then we're saying that within this three-week window between February 10th and March 5th, We would need to have a meeting, either a subcommittee meeting, talk with you individually, have a special hearing. We could do a teleconference commission meeting. But that would all have to happen, or any one of those things would have to happen between the 10th and the 5th. All right? And relative to salmon, that's typically the only thing that we get from you. You do hold hearings about management options because you implement regulations in state waters. Usually, you get that package of what the range of options is going to be. You take public comment. And it's a lot of times negotiated between the user groups at the council meeting as to how they're going to mix and match the range of options. So your involvement, you can give us direction primarily through the in-river allocation. The next item on there is the groundfish schedule. And I have to get a copy for myself. This, again, is an entire process that begins with this council meeting in September and ends in June of next year. It is an undertaking that the council does only every 2 years. So what we establish next June would be in effect for 2007 and 2008. What I have on the left column is the Pacific Fishery Management Council, the schedule that they have and what they undertake relative to groundfish in each of the meetings. The middle is your commission meetings and any subcommittee meetings that we might want to have. And then on the far right column is what the department will be doing during this entire time period. I've indicated in the yellow highlight those time periods that are important or may be important for the commission to consider, and then in the right-hand column, what kind of guidance we might be interested in getting from you. So on the first page, February meeting, sometime during February, would be a time for us to get together and talk about what is the commission's guidance to the department relative to what size of harvest targets should we establish at the council for these species that are important to California that are contained in our nearshore plan. And this year, we're lucky enough to have three stock assessments, one on scorpionfish, gopher rockfish, and then a reassessment of cabazon. So we would be coming to the commission with a range of harvest targets and giving you some background as to why we think one would be better than another and ask for guidance. That's not necessarily what the council will decide because there are 14 voting members and I am only one, but it does give us an indication of what the commission's desire might be. And then in March, the council would select a preferred harvest target. Between March and June, then we work on developing management options that would achieve and not exceed those harvest targets. So I've indicated that possibly in May, early May, or after your commission meeting, we might want to have a discussion about how the options are shaping up, what the seasons might be looking like for your information, and an opportunity for the public to talk to you about what they would prefer out of the range of options that we currently have. That's more of a informational and just a dialogue because, like I said, what actually gets decided upon is a lot based on negotiations between different sectors of the fishery, the boat-based people and the recreationals and the commercials in different parts of the state. Those are two subject matters that the council deals with. The other two are coastal pelagic species, which the state doesn't manage anymore. It's all through federal management, and the only one that we manage is squid. So we come to you all the time with squid issues. And the other is highly migratory species, and that includes swordfish, marlin, some of the sharks, tunas. There may be a possibility that we'll be coming to the commission to discuss your guidance relative to some bag limits that might be proposed for some of those species in this next year. So that's an opportunity to engage the commission in this. The marine protected areas, went through that already with you. The guidance was already given several years ago. New things that come up relative to that, we can inform you and give you an opportunity to say, yes, we're involved, we want to be involved or not. But I want you to pay attention to the fact that there is this schedule that's structured. It's set up 2 years in advance. We don't change dates. And a lot of times the commission meeting dates and the council meeting dates are at odds with each other, and it just doesn't make it possible to do that. So that's the scenario of how the two operate and where you might get involved.
Well, I think that timeline was quite helpful. Commissioner Hatoy probably knows more about the discussion that occurred as to whether that's adequate for the rest of the commission.
I think they'll be happy with it because that's the reality of where
the schedule.
The salmon thing is always a crunch, and there's nothing anybody can do about that.
Right.
That's just the presentation and the schedule, and we always have a 2-week window to deal with an incredibly complicated issue, and there's no getting around that. So we'll just have to crunch, you know. So, okay, thank you.
Great. Quick comment.
Quick comment.
Bob Osborne, United Anglers again. That was a good presentation by the department on the schedules for normal management routines for the council. A great deal of the decisions that are made by the council are driven by the fishery management plans and the policies that are within those plans, including the schedules that are set by the plans and so forth. And for the most part, there's not a whole lot of policy decisions that are being made. There's a lot of... California does insert itself in the nearshore plan issue with policies related to control rules adopted in the nearshore plan and a few other policy areas. And there are sometimes occasionally allocation issues that pop up and things like that, and Maria was pointing out some of the important ones on the list. I think also needs to be addressed, you know, is the FMP amendment process, the development of FFPs, and the amendment process for surrounding FMPs. And those processes typically run out anywhere from you know, over a year usually, typically about 2 years and sometimes longer. And so there are, during those processes of developing those amendments, there's a few periods of time when commission input would be very desirable. Thank you.
That's good, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move on now. Now we'll go to item number 7. Apologize, Maria, that I tried to shorten your presentation.
Our director of Marine Region is going to say something.
Yes, looks like Gary's coming up.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Stacey, the new kid on the block, the regional manager for the department's Marine Region. Commissioner Hatoy, Commissioner Gustafson, Mr. Trainer, commission staff. We brought this item on the agenda to try to get some feedback from you in terms of how you see these subcommittee meetings working for you. Can we make them work for you better in terms of what you want? And also would like to share with you a little bit about some of the things that we're seeing from the standpoint of making sure that we're making your time effective in terms of going through these. In the past, my staff tells me that these were a more informal process where we had an opportunity to sit around a table. There was free interchange between the commissioners, department staff, and members of the public. These are a little bit, some people would say they're a lot more formal from the standpoint. This is the first one that's been taped, as I recall. Our desire is to try to get some feedback and guidance from the commission about some of the things that we're presenting in terms of, are we on the right track? An example might be the things with, for example, the Tanner crab fishery that we just explained. Getting some feedback in terms of some issues that might pop into your brain as we're presenting the presentation. One problem I recognize is the timing of when you get the documents relative to the date that you'd set the subcommittee meeting for, but to be able to get a little bit more guidance from you in terms of the kinds of things that, that you would like more information about, or if you, you have some questions about, or some directions in terms of additional information you'd like generated. Another example is, for example, with the PFMC discussion that we just had, would it be helpful, for example, to come to you during this window when salmon regulations are being generated, kind of give you a heads up of where things are heading, what's being involved? Would something like that be helpful? But overall, the format, we're just wondering if this is productive for you in terms of being able to answer questions that you may have. And that's the kind of guidance that we're looking for. This is your subcommittee meeting. I note that in terms of, again, being the new kid with a little bit different perspective, first one of these I've been to, I'm wondering if this isn't turning into a third day of the commission meetings. So and just from the standpoint of maybe the format, so is there something along those lines that you might want to look at? We're looking for some guidance
from
you.
Well, I think I'm newer than you are, so I'm going to defer to the senior commissioner here.
If I'm going to comment, even though I'm not on either subcommittee, but because I'm a commissioner who then is expected to, and I usually do, take the recommendations of the subcommittees, I'd like to know that when my colleagues come to the rest of the commission and say the subcommittee on the Marine Subcommittee or the Isle Township Subcommittee has heard this issue, it's a complicated issue. We had presentations. We had give and take. I, as one commissioner, want to make sure that's indeed the case. And then if a decision's made and a briefing is done, I'm going to trust, of course, that there are people smarter than me, believe it or not, and that they've been properly briefed. Having said that, and let me just say, there's talk that there's going to be another subcommittee, possibly called the Budget Subcommittee, which I'm advocating that myself and Cindy are on so we can deal with all the other issues like getting more marine biologists and other things. I would like to see it a more informal, loose, comfortable give and take among department staff and commissioners and public participation from the sense of an informal process. Steve's going to hate me, but I don't like that this subcommittee meeting is now taped because it puts everybody in a formal notice situation. I would like to have people sitting around a table. This is a commission. I think this meeting is for commissioners to get informed about complicated issues by people in the department and people in the public who have, you know, an important contribution to make. I would love to see people all sitting around, raising their hand, give and take, back and forth. But when it's taped, when it's agendized and noticed, when there's a microphone, people take on a whole official role. I learn less that way. So I'd like to, in the future, my recommendation will be to Mr. Rogers, who's looking at this now as a new thing, get as much information as you can, make it informal and comfortable for people to talk about what they really think and feel, because come tomorrow, I'm going to sit here and hear all of this again, and that's not going to be so helpful, because I do listen and I do ask questions. So to me, I think, you know, like I said, make it informal. Don't make it an official recorded meeting. Not that we're trying to keep the public out. That's not my intention. It's to make everybody feel comfortable in an informal give and take. So that's just my suggestion, and I'm not on either subcommittee, so they can tell me to take a hike, but we'll see what happens. You know.
As a follow-up to that, excuse me, as a follow-up that, Commissioner Hattori, several of the presentations that we gave today were not intended, nor were they presented in a formal way.
Right.
And yet this is a what seems to be a way to present them formally.
But they're all excellent. They were excellent. So, as formal as they can get, they probably couldn't get better. But I'm just saying I don't want people to feel like it was a data point presentation and all that kind of stuff. Okay.
Well, from my perspective, and this relates more to my past experience on various subcommittees and boards and commissions, typically your subcommittees are the chance to really get more in-depth into issues and have more dialogue on the critical issues, and not typically the day before you're hearing the item again.
Right.
In other words, today's agenda would typically be on issues we'd be looking at in September or later in the fall. It would be very helpful to have more materials in advance. I find it hard to, and especially today, first time running a meeting of the subcommittee, trying to read the material and ask intelligent questions on a top and in an area that I need a lot more knowledge base in to participate. So having materials, even a rough outline of what items are going to be covered and a little background on the issue ahead, even if not all the documents are prepared, just that briefing would be somewhat helpful on the items. But I would agree, in formal setting, more materials in advance and trying to agendize items that we may not need immediate action on. Or, for instance, on items 8 and 9, we've been all around the state. I'm not sure what the intent is on the updates. We can do that real quickly, I hope, because tomorrow and the next day we'll be dealing with those items. And I wouldn't want to take everybody's time feeling that they have to be here to testify today and then be here Thursday and Friday as well. So
you raise an excellent point that might be a good segue into thinking about, as the department generated some suggestions for that agenda, our intent with putting those two there was not to get into the formalized process of looking, but just to basically bring you up to date. Here's what's happened. Here's some of the comments we've heard. Here's how we're looking at it. Here's some suggestions that we're going to be looking at in terms of how we might deal with these concerns. Because I agree, it doesn't seem to be a good use of all of our time to essentially go through again what you're likely going to hear tomorrow.
Or all their time, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, correct. All of our time, correct.
Exactly.
Okay. So where do we go next?
I think we talk to the...
Yeah, I think we'll need to talk to the other commissioners. Okay. And
we'll be looking forward to some direction from you in terms of how you'd like... when and how you'd like to handle the next...
Great.
Yep. All right, thank you very much.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? I know there were some people that attended today that have already spoken on this. Just as it relates to this item, nothing else.
Paul Weakland. I am not a new kid on the block, but Mr. Stacy is absolutely right. All this ended up being is another day of commission meetings. We're going to have to rehash the whole thing. Last year, the Fish and Game admitted that the meetings were a farce, it's a charade, and all you do is double-do everything, and no value or worth is coming out of these subcommittee meetings. It's just a waste of time and money for all these department people to come and have a day at the beach.
Thank you for your comments. Okay. Now we'll go
Maria,
on to...
Maria has a comment.
Oh, I'm sorry?
No, and Saki has a comment.
Okay.
Everyone has suggestions.
Line up.
Everyone has suggestions on how to make us better. Imagine that.
I have no suggestion. I'm asking for some guidance. Tomorrow's meeting, the paperwork I gave you today was detailed,
right.
And I'd like some idea of what you feel might be useful tomorrow in the department's report relative to this agenda item about how does the commission get involved in policy at the council. If you think one of those graphics is sufficient, I can do that in that little one-pager on salmon. That would be...
Mm-hmm. Again, I can't speak for the other commissioners because I wasn't part of the discussion that asked that this item be agendized. So,
unfortunately, the people that were very concerned about this were Mr. Rogers, Mr. Kellogg, and Mr. Flores, and none of them are here. So, you know, I think you may have to present how it's done again. Unfortunately, not hypocrisy, and the condensing it and just, you know, showing the complicated nature, the, you know, sanctuary process versus the Magnuson process, you know, that I learned a lot about that today. So I think, you know, that it has to be done because those are the ones who really were, you know, upset about things. Thanks.
Yes. Sanki.
Commissioner, it's very short. One thing you might want to look at in terms of Gary's discussion about format. One of your other subcommittees, the Altoucher Preserving Hunting and Fishing Committee, is, I think, a good model. It's very informal. We eat lunch, everybody, all the participants. It's a roundtable kind of process. We actually assign work to everybody who shows up. And we actually get a lot done. And it's extremely informal. We have some very informal, sometimes scary discussions. And it's been very productive. I know Bob's attended a lot, and as has Adriana.
Cool. We can learn from that.
Yeah, you might ask Mr. Flores, who's the chair. At least I feel from my experiences, that's a very productive and very conducive to we've actually got NGOs to do work out of it.
That's good.
Which is always exciting. So this is just as a recommendation.
And maybe they can incorporate the Barefoot Ecologist into the Barefoot Hunter program.
Wonderful idea. No, right. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Good. Great. Here we go.
Oh, Steve's going to be opposed to the shutting down
of the video. No. Quite the contrary. Steve Matthew, AGP Video, slow span and cal span on the internet. Just as a point of clarity, we have no intention of doing these on a regular basis unless somebody steps up and pays. But we have over the years been requested to do somewhat of a Whitman sampler, and you're now being just caught in that Whitman sampler. I may never shoot this meeting again, or I may, but... Folks are interested in what do the subcommittees do. This will be on the internet, in the archives, on slowspan.org and calspan.org. And because people will view it, I wanted to clarify that. No, we're not going to be out here every time. I think you should have your subcommittee meetings any way you want to. We did call and ask, though, because you were in my neighborhood, made it economically feasible for me to come out and do this.
Great.
So
thank
people
you.
Can poke their finger on us and see what's inside.
Okay, we're going to move on now to the updates, both on the Abalone Recovery Management Plan, and we'll start there and then we'll make this brief, I hope.
Very brief. Good afternoon, John Ugaretz with the Department's Marine Region out of Monterey. And as you are likely aware, as I know you both attended some of the meetings, we've had five.
Yeah.
Meetings in the past month, I had the pleasure of going to three, and you did four?
You did four.
Good for you.
He did four. I only did two.
Yeah, I didn't see you, so I know you couldn't have done more than two. For the Abalone plan, comments were fewer than the other portion of the meeting, and in fact, a couple of meetings were very low attendance for Abalone. This plan has been discussed at great length over many years, and is really, from the department's perspective, ready to go. Some of the big comments we heard, though, were important, especially at the earlier meetings, and those focused in part around the issue of data collection and the data behind some of the numbers in the plan. And I'll be presenting you with some slides tomorrow that show what we've been able to do in the past month as a response to that. We really did make a concern.
That's why you weren't at the two I was at. You were out in the field, is what I was told.
Unfortunately, I was not in the field. I was at other meetings.
Oh, okay. everyone else was.
Everybody else was out in the field, and that's why you got to watch a video of them doing their presentation, which I'm sure was enjoyable. Important, though, in the data we've collected, two items. We did two sites in the North Coast this month, two of the index sites, one of which is one of your new index sites that we added based on commission comment, and then two sites had been done in 2003. So we basically, in the past 2 years, have done four sites on the North Coast. And we wanted to assess the 6,600 abalone per hectare number, which we are calling the sustainable fishery level, which was the average of three sites back a few years ago. And using those four sites over the past 2 years, the average right now of those four sites is over 8,000 abalone per hectare, which indicates that 6,600 number is reasonable. It's definitely something that's achievable, and in the past several years of fishing those areas at the level we have right now, they have not declined lower than that. So that's a good thing. With regards to San Miguel Island, we had presented a slide in the early presentations that stopped at around 1999 or 2000, and a big question came up as to what's happened since then and what about some of the areas that have more abalone in them as opposed to those traditional index sites there. And we went back and we were able to actually get the information that has been collected over the past 5 years at those sites, as well as this year's information that we just got a week ago. And essentially, things look about the same as they have at San Miguel. The site at Wyckoff Ledge, which was the lower density site, has been declining over the past couple years. But those are fixed transects. They're not random like we do on the North Coast. And it's very understandable for densities to decrease on a fixed transect because abalone move. And so without doing random transects, you don't get a great picture. But they're still in the ballpark they were in. Also, what's important to note is that if you take the five-year average at the more dense site at Miracle Mile, That five-year average is over 7,000 abalone per hectare. Again, showing that that 6,600 abalone per hectare number is reasonable, not only on the North Coast, but at San Miguel Island as well. The other site, the low-density site that I mentioned earlier at Wyckoff Ledge, is much lower than that. It's 10 times lower than that at about 600 abalone per hectare. So again, you're seeing that there are variabilities between sites. What we intend to do in the next month at San Miguel Island is go out and do some random transects so we can get a better feel for what the total density is at San Miguel Island. We're going to use some locations that some of the fishermen provided us several years back and redo those sites that we did earlier. So that's our intent, and hopefully between this meeting and your next meeting, we'll have even more information about San Miguel and maybe one of the other Channel Islands. Other things in regards to the abalone plan, that was the biggest comment that was very important to us to address. The other comments we have heard before, we feel that they are addressed in the plan. We do want to note to you that you have alternatives in the plan, and it is up to your discretion as to which alternative you choose when you do adopt the plan.
Can you give us five?
There's actually seven alternatives to our preferred, with a variety. Several of them deal with opening some sort of commercial fishery in the southern part of the state, and the other about half of them deal with changes to the North Coast recreational fishery. And I'll go into some detail about what those alternatives are tomorrow. I don't need to hear it today and tomorrow. The other thing that I would note about the abalone plan is it's very important for you to understand and for the public to understand that you cannot, by law, open a fishery until you adopt this plan, and that's for south of San Francisco Bay. So we won't be adopting the plan tomorrow. We're going to discuss it again. You will be making a determination about the timeline for adoption of the plan and what you feel you need before you're ready to adopt it. And keep that in mind as you're making that determination. The other issue with adopting the plan is it sort of sends us out there to start collecting even more data, and it gives us the direction to do that. And we've gone ahead and started that data collection now because we feel it's important for you to understand and be comfortable with adopting the plan, but once you adopt it, you even give us more direction to do that. And that's about all I'll say unless you had some questions
tomorrow
about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think we'll cover this more in depth tomorrow with all the commissioners.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Okay. Going on to Marine Life Protection Act, unless you wanted to...
No. Okay. Just keep going.
Very good. Marine Life Protection Act. Again, we had the five hearings, and we did get some very good comments, both written and orally at the meetings, in between the meetings and at the meetings. And what you have seen in your packet as of probably yesterday is a revised draft of that master plan framework. And I would note that the revisions, while not major and easy to understand, are very important for you to look at, and I will go over them in some detail tomorrow. They are in response to the public comment, to the comments we received from the commissioners, and to the comments we received at the Blue Ribbon Task Force. They are very responsive to a variety of major issues, and I want to just briefly run through some of those so you have a feel for it. But we have re-emphasized and made it more clear that modification to existing marine protected areas is key to the process. It's not just about new areas. We have emphasized and made more clear a statement that was already in the document that at a minimum we are looking for an administrative network linked by common goals, common process, enforcement, and implementation and management, and that while biological networking is desirable, it is not possible everywhere, and we don't expect that it will be. We have emphasized the fact that the science may change, and though we are recommending that you keep scientific recommendations in the plan, we are certainly willing to change those recommendations if new science becomes available or is brought to our attention. We've also put in some language that makes it clear that not only might the master plan be changed and adapted based on lessons learned, but we expect it to change, and in particular based on the lessons we've learned from the Central Coast process. So your adoption of this framework document doesn't mean that we put it on the shelf and use it forever as is. We clearly intend to make changes based on what we learned. There were some statements in the document that were holdovers from previous versions that had never been caught before and were brought to our attention by some of the public comment, in particular in the introduction to the species likely to benefit section in the appendix. There was, in one paragraph, a statement that said we're only looking at species that are fished, and yet in two paragraphs later we noted that actually the list itself includes more than that. And so we revised that introductory language to make it much clearer that there are a whole variety of reasons beyond fishing that things might benefit from being in an MPA. We've also revised some of the language about key species in that there's this huge broad list of species that might benefit from MPAs. In each region, we need to take a very clear look at what are the key critical species and how do particular proposals impact them or not. Finally, I just want to reiterate to you today, and I will do it again tomorrow, that this is a complex document, and you will hear comment that it is a complex document. This is also a complex process and a very involved process with a lot of viewpoints. I feel that a complex document is necessary to adequately do it justice in implementation. Again, we expect it to change from lessons learned and new science point, and that this framework document is a starting point for implementation in the rest of the state, and we don't intend to finish implementation of Marine Life Protection Act until 2011, and there's a long time ahead of us to revise and modify and make things work. And that's all I had on that one.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks for the updates. Apparently, there is somebody who wanted to address the abalone.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you mind coming up to the microphone? I'm sorry. We won't have them next time. So.
My name's Jim Marshall. some of you have seen me, met me before or heard me speak. Of course, I have a lot of things to say, and I think looking at the time and the way things have gone, and now I'm confused. Is tomorrow hearing?
Tomorrow's the hearing.
Friday. No.
Friday.
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 Thank you. I'm
Friday.
So sorry.
That's what I was thinking. That's why I wanted to get in at the Marine Subcommittee, because Friday's a little more difficult for me. I think probably in the interest of saying what I want to say, and in fact I brought some presentations which I need an overhead projector, maybe I should just wait till to the opportunity on Friday, and then everybody could go home.
I think more importantly that all the commissioners
and then all the commissioners
hear you at the same
well,
time on those
and
issues.
That would, I was a little chagrined that you were forced to come down and limp in and
it's somewhat duplicative
because we've been
on people's work.
It goes with the territory. I know you bought in, right?
Right. So come on down.
No, I think that would be better, and I appreciate Bob you making an effort to get me on here today, but. As I say, I think it's let's go home.
Okay.
I mean, unless there's something else.
There is one more item, and that is to schedule the location for the next. I'm sorry, yes. I'm sorry.
Hi, thank you. My name is Steve Reebok. My family was in a commercial business back to the 40s. My family moved to Morro Bay in 54, fish abalone. I started diving locally here in 1956 when I was 9 years old. And up until a few years ago, I represented the commercial divers on these issues. I'm glad to hear that there's been some work done at San Miguel recently. That's good news. But I'm concerned that a significant fishing ground in the Farallon Islands is being left out here. Approximately 10% of the red abalone in 97 was coming from the Farallons. As far as I know, there was one survey done out there with an ROV, which is a little submarine. But that equipment cannot get down in the understory kelps that occur at the Farallon Islands, and so their counts were pretty small. I think it's very important that the Farallons be brought back into the discussion here, because it was a significant fishing ground. Another cause of decline that was used, I think, against commercial fishermen in 97 was... the fact that sea otters were translocated to San Nicolas Island in 1987, beginning in 87. And according to Fish and Game's own documents, 40% of red abalone landings were coming from San Nicolas Island at the time. By the early 90s, that number had dropped to zero. And so as the landing data, the ex-vessel data was used to show a decline, I don't believe that it was really clearly stated that there was reasons for that decline besides fishing pressure. At the last meeting, and I don't remember if Mr. Hattoy was in Santa Barbara.
I was there.
On the 12th. I know Ms. Gustafson was not there.
I
but
was not there.
I did some homework on the area of the sea otter range here, and sea otters over time will eliminate shellfish down to about 10% of their natural densities without sea otters. So using the available numbers, I came up with 8 million to 115 million red abalone in this area between Point San Pedro and Point Conception. And I suspect that one will say that we can't fish here anymore because those densities are so small that they're needed for procreation. But I look at this area and these densities of abalone as a safety net. And I would have to argue against this 6,600 number that abalone densities are not uniform. Even on the North Coast, they're not uniform. There's areas where you have plenty of food, you got all the right habitat, find none. Other areas are stacked up 3 and 4 high. So trying to create this uniform density, that's what you have to support a fishery, I think is really not doable. And I just want to bring that to your attention. I'll save everything else for Friday.
And I have one quick question.
Sure.
And
I don't mean this flippantly, but the Farallon Islands, given the tides and the weather, and this amazing book I just read called The Devil's Teeth, the fact that it's like a shark cuisinart out there, I mean, who's going to count them and who wants to do that and who, I mean, okay, I'm just saying, I might want you to. Wait. I might want you to, Paul. We might finally agree on something. Go to the Farallons and count the abalone. No, but I hear you. Wait, we're not arguing. But I'm saying, honestly, the real answer is I just don't know the answer to that.
No, I think you saw in that book Ron Elliott. Yes, he dives urchins. I've seen him on the Discovery Channel with those large white shark start swimming over him. Jim Marshall's worked in that area. There's probably about 10 guys that specialize out there. If we move forward with this barefoot ecologist concept, right. I mean, you got guys
that be a no-foot ecologist as far as...
And Mr. Weakland's one of them. The guys that have the knowledge and the ability to coexist with those sharks and dive safely. So the answer is yes.
So the answer is yes. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for your comments. Okay. Mr. Weakland, real quick.
It's a little flower I've saved. You notice that the closure of Blacks was in 1993. And if you would notice on there, the first and foremost reason for closing the fishery is withering syndrome. That was the first and foremost reason for closing the fishery. Now they want to sweep it under the carpet. They don't want to admit what they've done, their environmental terrorism, their ecological sabotage, and the crimes against nature that the department committed with the outplanting of their diseased abalones. This is not accurate. If this is such a good job and they worked on it so hard and it's so perfect, why are they afraid of peer review? Peer review is a required process. They had peer review years ago on a document that is not even similar to this one. No peer review. They're afraid of peer review. Why? The number 6,600 is not scientific. The peer review pointed that out. But have they done anything to correct their document according to the peer review that they had? No. Was it scathing and critical of their document? Yes, it was. And the document has been changed so much, so many times, peer review is necessary and required.
Thank you. Yes. We sat here all day.
My name's April Wakeman. I represent United Anglers of Southern California. And I'm going to talk about the MLPA. You folks have listened to us. We'd like some guidance from the commission. We don't know whether to keep bombarding you with information, whether we've already been persuasive, or whether we've so totally turned you off to our views. So it would be very nice in the next meetings to get a little feedback on where the commission's going so we know what to focus in on, what we need to explain further, and where we're going. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on, if you keep us here any longer, Mr. Sea Otter, you know what I mean?
Unfortunately, I can't be at the meeting tomorrow, so
okay.
I apologize.
Okay, no problem.
I just want to comment on public process and the fact that I think that one of the things that's really important as you evaluate both Channel Islands and the master plan framework that's before you, and that's what I want to address, is has it gone through extensive public process? And in other words, after that public process, do you really want to jump in and try and start changing things? I would recommend not. But the reason, the basis for that comment is simply because of the extensive public process that the MLPA framework has already been through. There were multiple meetings, multiple rewrites, multiple opportunities for stakeholder and public comment throughout the drafting of the master plan framework. I hope you would honor that process. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no others, we'll move to item 10. because I'm the only member of the committee here, I can set the meeting. But we'll try to head for mid-September, I think, and we'll work it out with staff and hopefully Commissioner Rogers. I was thinking Richards. Richard Rogers. To set that.
Mr. That was really, Paul, I usually don't argue with you, but don't say stuff like that. Okay, go ahead, sorry.
I apologize. I didn't catch that.
It doesn't die.
That's a very sad thing to say. Anyway, so we'll work that out and get that out to you. We'll aim for mid-September, and you'll hear from us at that time. Are there any items, Commissioner Hattoy, you'd like on that agenda?
No, I'm out of here.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you for attending today. We really appreciate all of your input. We look forward to being here and to seeing you the next 2 days.